Thanks for listening to WRIF Online. The live web stream will begin in 15 seconds.
Boyne Country Sports has a cool December offer exclusively for WRIF Online listeners. Receive 20% off your next purchase with any purchase of $100 or more. Offer valid at both Boyne Country Sports locations in Novi and Bloomfield Hills. Click on the Boyne Country Sports banner above for details.
Award-winning night call, the Riff's Phone-In Talk Show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much. You're welcome, everybody. We'll start with the pledge. Everybody stand, please.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the multinational corporations and to the profit for which they stand. One interlocking directorate under no government, indivisible, with monopoly and cheap labor for all.
All right, thank you very much. Please be seated. That was Utah Phillips from his double CD, I've Got to Know. Utah Phillips, an old guy from the Industrial Workers of the World, the old, what they call the Wobblies. Go to IWW.org. Oh, that was, what is this? Oh, that's my theme. I thought it was more Metallica. Let's welcome Jalene Jordan. Hi, Jalene.
Hello, Peter. That was a great way to start the show.
Yeah, yeah. This is a terrific double album. Utah Phillips is in the tradition of the old wobbly folk singers and storytellers. And you can get this from akpress.org. Jalene Jordan is now officially, drum roll please.
Oh.
Yeah. He's now Night Call's producer, and this is, you know, this is not the first time.
No, it's come kind of full circle, I guess. I started as your producer at the end of 98, and then I left. Oh, I don't know. Doug Podell had me doing so many other rock and roll things that I left, and you've had several producers in between.
Sure.
And it was just kind of fitting for me to come back.
And then we were a team. You were the producer and my on-air co-host with the old IE America Radio Network, where we did a nationally syndicated show 5 days a week.
Oh, yeah.
And almost went, how do people do that? We almost went crazy.
I know.
I like this one. So we always get email from people saying, have you approached Air America or Nova M? And I'm going, yeah, come on, man.
It's workers of the world, relax.
Exactly, exactly.
It's good to be back, Peter.
Yes, welcome to the show, everybody. Night Call this hour is brought to you by Waking Up. It's Metro Detroit's sweatshop free clothing store. It's located in the Universal Mall at 12 Mile Road in DeQuinder in Warren. You can visit their website, wakingupstore.com. You ever been out there?
I haven't, but I did meet the owner at one of the protests that we went to, or peace rallies, whatever we say these days. And you know what? In all of this holiday frenzy, which is absolutely driving me batty this year, I don't know, it's really on my last nerve. But if I were going to go anywhere to do some shopping,
sure,
which I'm not doing any, I'm boycotting this year, I would go there. Definitely, because they have all of the fair trade products and things like that, which, I mean, we just need to be more socially conscious consumers.
Exactly. Did I tell you, and remember, you know the rule, we cannot mention my dear wife's name.
Yes,
or
yes.
My dog's name.
Which is really funny.
Or the gender of the dog.
I mean, how neurotic is that, Peter?
You think she's neurotic? Maybe she's listening. She's got her reasons.
But I'm a neurotic dog owner, too.
It's okay. She's neurotic about the dog. I thought you meant about her name. All right.
No.
The number's here, 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. It's a phone-in talk show if you're joining us for the first time. You know, this has been on so long.
35 years? Is it true?
Well, Doug Podell in this article said 25 years, and he's the boss.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Where did that 10 years go? It was the lost years.
It was.
The 70s.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Were we on the air, man? Are we on the air now?
Yeah.
So call us. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com if you're bashful or just want to say something by email. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com, which since Jolene Jordan is here and was my partner on IE America, that's the email from old IE America.
I know. You kept it. Well, it works because a lot of the listeners of this show crossed over to the other show and vice versa.
Sure.
So it's just one big happy family.
Well, let me tell you this about Christmas. One of the things that maybe, you know, I'm getting soft in my advancing years or something like that because, you know, being a non-believer and certainly having no religion.
I'm the same.
I just hate it. Oh gosh.
I know. I went to this Christmas party last night and everyone, Merry Christmas, Jolene. And I just didn't want to explain. Thank you.
Well, I usually say Happy Holidays.
Right. That is PC.
Well, is it? You know, and I hate, well, that horrible, I don't want to give people any publicity, but that awful mean right-wing man that's this bully.
Which one?
On Fox News.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, on the television show.
Yeesh.
And, you know, a liar. I mean, he's just been caught in so much BS. Like all these guys. Have you noticed that all this house of cards that these guys have all been tumbling down?
Yes.
But last year, he said there was a war on Christmas.
Oh, really? Yeah, oh, is that what he has to say? Yeah. I'd like to punch that guy. Sorry. I don't believe in violence either, but that's one person.
Now, one of the things that my wife and I have been doing is we're not buying any presents, and what we do is we make a donation.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of in their name. I mean, in other words, we write, like my dad and his wife, and saying, we're donating money. We say in their name. I'm not going to give this group their name because then they'll get, you know, once you donate money, they keep wanting more from us.
Oh, sure.
So I just sent them $50.
To a positive organization doing good in the world.
And this was to the Sea Shepherds, the people that are protecting the sea, and our friend, Captain Paul Watson.
SeaShepherd.org, isn't it?
SeaShepherd.org, right.
You know, you can also, like, buy a goat or a half a goat for someone who's starving.
And what's
the
that
third
website?
World. You know what? I don't have it, but bad producer, right? I actually got a catalog in the mail.
Somebody did that for us as well. But here, let me. So I always stayed away from saying Merry Christmas.
Yeah.
And but here, this article in today's New York Times says an atheist can believe in Christmas. And it's talking about Richard Dawkins, who's this British evolutionary biologist at Oxford University. And he's written a book called The God Delusion. All these books about atheism suddenly are very, very popular. You know what it was? Bush and all these frauds have given religion such a bad name.
Oh, most
That's
definitely.
Why it is legitimized agnosticism and atheism and free thought, as they used to call it, and stuff like that. So there's really been this opening. So this book, The God Delusion by Richard Dawkins, is number 6 on the New York Times bestseller list. And another book by Sam Harris called The End of Faith, Religion, Terror, and the Future of Reason is by Sam Harris is number 6 in October. So out of nowhere, we're told 99.9% of everyone believes in a deity. And if you don't, you're some sort of freak.
Oh, absolutely. Right? You're going straight to hell.
Yeah.
That's what they tell us.
Well, I always, didn't I quote this last time? Were we talking about this last time? Because I quoted Mark Twain. He said, heaven for the climate, hell for the company.
Oh, no, I don't remember that one. But, you know, I was listening to some talk radio over the weekend, and these books are really creating a stir.
So you know of them.
In the religious community,
Yeah. Well, here's what Dawkins said. The New York Times emailed him and asked him something about, can't find it exactly, but he said, what do atheists do on Christmas? And so this is Dawkins. Presumably, your reason for asking me is that The God Delusion is an atheistic book, and you still think of Christmas as a religious festival. But of course, it has long ceased to be a religious festival. I participate for family reasons with a reluctance that owes more to aesthetics than atheistics.
Okay.
He says, right. I detest Jingle Bells, White Christmas, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, and the obscene spending bonanza that nowadays seems to occupy not just December, but November and much of October.
It really
as well.
Does. Yeah. It really does. It is obscene. That's a perfect word for it.
And so here is what he says as well. So divorced, and this is coming from an atheist. So divorced has Christmas become from religion that I find no necessity to bother with euphemisms such as happy holiday season. In the same way as many of my friends call themselves Jewish atheists, I acknowledge that I come from Christian cultural roots. I'm a post-Christian atheist, so understanding full well that the phrase retains zero religious significance, I unhesitatingly wish everyone a Merry Christmas.
Well, good for him. I still don't.
Yeah, I'll say Merry Christmas to everybody under that, sort of, proviso or whatever. One of the things, of course, that has also sent religion down the tubes deservedly, I mean, you think about this. I mean, I know so many decent religious people that whose faith, and you do too, that is their faith is the basis of their commitment to peace and social justice.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, I mean, think about Father Roy Bourgeois. Remember him?
Oh, absolutely. Down at the School of the Americas.
Yeah. People like that. I mean, I feel badly if I say, I'm an atheist, and guys like that, they just kind of look at you sadly. They won't even try to. They're not in your face.
That's right. My mother-in-law, as a matter of fact, is someone like that, and she's extremely, extremely religious.
Yeah.
But she will never say a bad word about me or anyone, and she knows that I'm not down with the program.
Well, here's another thing, of course. Now it turns out that. We always thought of the Democratic Party because of its one of its platforms is tolerance towards all people, including gays. So, like, the Democratic Party was the party the party of the gays, and the Republicans were the anti-gays, which they are.
Except for the log cabin Republicans.
Yeah, except right? and then all the preachers and all the chiefs of staff and the head of the Republican Party is gay. What's that guy, Melman or something like that? Yeah. So it's totally bizarre, and it's weird. They whip up homophobia as a way to gain votes, like all those terrible, disgraceful amendments that don't permit gay marriage. Mm-hmm. And in the meantime, I know you can't imagine this, that I'm going to say something good about, like Bush and these
what?
Other. Well, they actually don't appear to have any personal prejudices against anyone. They're really big on getting women in. Remember, they wanted to have this woman whose name I forget again as a Supreme Court Justice.
Yeah.
I mean, they got to be right wing, of course. And
she was pretty repulsive.
Well, whatever.
I remember.
And they have a lot of gay friends. And there was this Bush appointed somebody in the AIDS program as the head of it. And he brought along his male partner. And there was George and Laura just congratulating them like they weren't the biggest, leading the biggest homophobe charge since, I don't know.
It's all smoke and mirrors, isn't it?
It is all smoke and mirrors, to be sure. But also, here, this article from a few days ago in the Times, confessions by two evangelical Christian ministers to having same-sex relations could lead evangelicals to feel greater compassion towards gay men and lesbians because half your damn preachers are gay.
Let's just face it, people.
Yeah.
On that note, Jim and Tammy Faye Baker, remember them?
Yeah.
Okay, their son.
The kid's back.
He's a preacher, and he promotes tolerance, and he believes that gay people should be able to get married and that whole kind of thing. So maybe, in a way, he can bring some sanity to this whole religious movement.
And he's a punk minister.
He's cool, man.
He's piercing.
Yeah, he's got the stretchers in his ears, and he's got the tattoos all over. He's got he's got a piercing in his bottom lip, and he's just a great kid.
Do you ever kiss anybody like that?
I don't know if I should tell.
I just couldn't imagine it.
Maybe someone who had one in their tongue.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Even that seems a little weird.
Weird is to each individual person, right?
Let me see. Well, let's continue this conversation after midnight. I don't know. It's still after 10, but
keep it clean.
All right. On Sunday, the pastor of a suburban Denver church, the Reverend Paul Barnes, resigned after admitting to having sex with men. Mr. Barnes said he'd often cried himself to sleep, begging God. I mean, why am I laughing?
Peter, you're terrible.
Begging God to end his attraction to men.
Oh, wow.
I mean, aren't we supposed to be Buddhist? The two things, the two principal poles of Buddhism.
Compassion.
And awareness.
Yeah.
So I'm not being very compassionate, am I?
You're not. I think you're just, I don't know.
Yeah. But how come, God didn't listen to him?
Gee, I don't know. You know, that's what one of the things I was getting at with the Baker son is he was talking about this Haggard, is that the name?
Yeah.
Okay. And, you know, he was shunned from his church, and he said, you know what? That really disappointed him, because why did they have to shut them out and, like, put them, you know, on that island, so to speak, when we should take them, embrace them, and say, oh, you've... You know,
yeah.
Well, send in the eyes of the church or whatever.
I think Reverend
Ted Haggard.
Ted Haggard, yeah. Well, he led the Colorado campaign for a same-sex prohibition amendment.
So unbelievable.
He's a total of fraud. On the other hand, Reverend Paul Barnes, who was also, he resigned after admitting to having sex with men, his church abstained from it.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. Well, he's the latest, right? This is the latest one to come out. Okay.
So he's doing guys. And
so to speak.
But the big thing, and I asked a couple of my friends or colleagues here at the station, you know, I never know what's really, you know, I always depended on you to tell me what's happening in the real world.
Pop culture. Yes.
So Mary Cheney.
Oh, yeah.
She's having a baby.
She is. And I didn't realize she's been with her partner for something like 20 years.
Yeah, yeah.
Long time.
In this New York Times article, again, it says her partner is Heather Poe, P-O.
Right.
It says Mary Cheney and Ms. Poe are not married. Well, of course, you freak.
They can't be married.
Because your damn father.
Right.
And the guy whose hand he has up his back manipulating
him. Up his back, okay. Puppet. Okay,
puppet.
I see. I see what you're saying.
Right.
Yeah, well, now Bush comes out and says that Mary Cheney's going to be a good mother.
Yeah.
Well, gee, wasn't that kind of him?
Yeah. Yeah.
Aww.
Isn't that nice? And
so
they're all
sweet.
Just happy. That's what I mean. They don't, you know, they, I'm sure Bush is totally okay with it. So then you have, but so then he's particularly evil to believe personally intolerance, yet manipulate people within the general population to hate people that love one another. You've seen, I'm sure, and you, I know you know gay couples, men and women, as I do,
mm-hmm.
and you see these demonstrations of these of gays and their supporters, people like us, and they're filled with love, and they got their hands on their partner, and then you look across the street, and there are these good Christians going, killer,
It's but God hates fags, they say on these signs. I mean, just the most repulsive.
Well, we shouldn't. That's that nutcase from Kansas. Most of them aren't that bad.
He's part of them. I don't know. Yeah. Maybe they are, Peter.
So anybody have any thoughts on that? Peter Werby and Jelaine Jordan here at WRIF. 313-298-WRIF. 313-298-9743. And Jelaine's looking at me in amazement that I'm still having to read the phone numbers. I can't remember phone numbers.
That's okay.
All right. There's lots of other stuff as well. But hey, let's take some calls. I don't know how we're going to do this. Either both of us can answer or...
I say you do it. It's your show.
Okay. Here's Pete in Royal Oak. Pete, hi. It's Peter Werby, Jelaine Jordan, WRIF. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing? Just a comment. I was going to make another comment about another thing, but just here on the top of Haggard, I heard that his congregation said that the devil was inside of him, and that's what caused him to stray from, you know, his mission.
I think it was another guy.
Yeah, well,
but whatever.
But okay. I watched. I put on the Deer Hunter tonight.
Oh yeah.
And I loved the movie. Haven't watched it in probably about 10 years. And what struck me about the movie tonight, you know, after watching it, was the fact that nothing's really changed. I mean, that movie was about Vietnam. What's going on in Iraq, pretty much the same thing. You know, we've got guys getting killed over there, and we've got a lot of guys coming home in wheelchairs. And
At all.
More than ever. More wounded, severely wounded, because of all the armament and also medical facilities. So you have 20,000 to 25,000... American GIs coming home with absolutely catastrophic wounds that they're going to have to bear the brunt of. And Bush is saying, "Oh, don't rush me to make a decision. I'm going to make it in January. In the meantime, every day. Oh, wow. Go ahead.
It's hard. It's hard to deal with. You know, watching. You know, you don't see these people. That's the thing. We don't see them in our community. We don't see them walking around. I got a guy across the street that lives across the street from me here in Royal Oak. Sweet guy. When I moved in my house, he was the first guy to shake my hand, welcome me to the neighborhood. Well, he's a Vietnam veteran. He's got severe mental handicaps. I mean, he came up to me a couple weeks after I moved in, this is 2 years ago, saying that, he was a machine, a door gunner, a machine gun, or a helicopter, and he killed American troops. And it screwed up his mind. And you know, he's forgotten, you know, just like a lot of these guys are coming back right now are going to be forgotten. And the Veterans Administration hasn't been doing anything for a lot of these guys. I mean, they forget them. And
yeah, they're cutting Bush's budget cuts back.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And you know, they're just like, you know, a lot of these guys, they don't, you know, they're going because they're poor, you know. They go over there because they have no other options. There's no work in Michigan, whatever, or down south, or whatever city. Or they get brainwashed. And for what, I guess, is my question. And
well, I think that's an important question. For what? We haven't figured this out, that the original deal has completely ended. And now, where, like, for instance, here's just one story from the middle of the week from the Associated Press. Three more U.S. troops died in fighting this week, and this is, like, on Friday, raising to 54 the number of Americans killed in Iraq in December, nearly half of them in the Anbar province. So who are they fighting there? They're fighting Iraqis who are fighting against the American invaders and occupiers. Us, in other words, our sons and daughters and fathers and mothers and what have you. And we don't even know what they want. The real far right wing religious fanatics aren't among the Sunnis. They're among the Shiites, and those are like our buddies. All right, thank you very much, Pete. I appreciate you calling into 313-298-WRIF. In the meantime, the deaths continue, and one of the Bush twins, Jenna, she's down dancing the tango with her Argentine boyfriend for Christmas. Why the hell isn't she in the service? Why didn't she show the way? Jenna Bush, one of U.S. President George W. Bush's twin daughters, is planning to celebrate the Christmas holidays in the United States with a new Argentine boyfriend, Ramiro Gonzalez Palazzo. He's a public relations student and marketing agency owner, and he's captured the heart of Jenna, 24.
You know I love the Bush twins. They're the only good thing about the Bush family.
Yeah.
They're out partying.
Party animals.
And Barney, the dog.
Barney, the dog.
And then
cool.
The other dog.
Yeah.
That's the only good thing.
By the way, what I thought was absolutely amazing is that the recruitment quotas for 2006 have actually been met. And you would think, I mean, I know two sons of friends of mine who have actually joined.
Really?
Yeah, both of them were, one said to me, oh, it's going to be over by the time I, you know, before I get through training.
Oh, boy.
Other one, there was other aspects to it. But the Army believed they could recruit an extra 20,000 soldiers a year. Well, one of the things they did was they raised the age to 42.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
So there's cases, like there's a mother and daughter. Like 42-year-old mother, 18-year-old
right.
daughter. And also, I was talking to friends last night, and this woman was telling me they're trying to recruit her niece as soon as she finishes high school. This woman is 17. She weighs 240 pounds. She has diabetes.
Mm.
And they're telling her, we'll get you in basic training. We'll knock that weight off of you. And I'm thinking, this is the Army of the United States of America.
Wow.
42-year-old mothers and essentially ill and overweight young people.
Yeah, it used to be what flat feet would get you rejected, right?
Yeah, exactly. Hey, well, actually, this might be a good time to play this. Oh, I thought I had enough information on this. Now, this is a video that is on my website. And it's called I Died for a Comma. A comma, ooh, like a typographical little sign
yeah.
there. Well, you could tell what it was meant because I was making the sign in my with my finger, but I didn't know if everybody else could. It's a terribly disturbing video, and the first part of it sets what it's about. And we're going to play the Julene Jordan album later, too.
Not the whole thing.
Not the whole thing. But this, it takes a while to get into it, so I'm only going to play the first little bit of it. And it has Bush commenting on Iraq to begin with. And I know you can do anything with, like, Pro Tools and other programs.
Yeah, you can manipulate
audio. He really said this. So, and by the way, this was sent to me by Bill Helsel. And let's see, he says, where is this? The Zed Jones Unit. And it says copyright 2006, David Kaufman. So I guess that's who did this, the Zed Jones Unit. You can see the whole video and hear the whole song on my website, PeterWerbe.com, PeterWerbe.com. Here's I Died for a Comma. Come on. I think.
I like to tell people when the final history is written on Iraq, it'll look like just a comma, 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 comma.
Sets the tone like that for quite a while. Actually, a friend of ours in Ann Arbor, I sent this to her, and she said there's much more to it. And here's Bush. Iraq will just be a comma. Well, sure. It will be to Jenna Bush, who's just boinking her Argentine boyfriend during the Christmas season.
Life is good.
But as Pete said, these soldiers coming home, not only injured physically, but so many of them, what they saw in any kind of guerrilla war, particularly war is hell to be sure, but all of that. I mean, these people are despicable. It would be unbelief.
That's just inexcusable, the died for a comma. That's the first time that I have heard that, Peter. And I just feel so bad for anyone who is over there now or who is back now who may be listening tonight. And, you know, that is, almost lost it right there.
I hate to say it, or I hate to do it in a way, but here, let's play Bush again.
I like to tell people when the final history is written on Iraq, it'll look like just a comma, comma, comma.
Yeah, just a comma. It'll look like a comma to you, George. Just like Vietnam looked like a comma to you because your rich daddy got you out of the army and out of the meat grinder of Vietnam and got you some cushy job.
Well, he was snorting up half of Peru. Peru.
Yeah, that's right. Peter Werbe here with you. Julene Jordan is with me. And let's take some calls. I guess this is a talk show, right?
Yes.
Well, here, some people want to talk about gay marriage. Rick in Monroe. Rick, hey, it's Peter Werbe, Julene Jordan. Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, Peter, how you doing?
Doing good.
That's good. I was hearing you guys talking about, I caught on just a little bit late, heard you talk about how you're saying somebody was saying God hates fags.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to kind of get what you were saying. Who was it that said that? I guess
that's Fred Phelps.
Yeah, Reverend Fred Phelps.
Oh yeah, another member of the religious community, and he is just he's despicable. That's the best word for him.
He pickets soldiers. Yeah. He's the guy that pickets the soldiers' funerals.
It's so interesting to me how, and it's not you. It's the media in general. It's so funny how they always seem to pick on the. The fundamentalist Christians, I guess they pick the most
freaky.
Yeah, man, yeah. And that's the image that Christians seem to get across the nation, you know, whether it be on a television show or on anything. And it's just, I don't think that that's the dominant belief system of most Christians.
I actually agree, and yeah. I did disagree some, as you may or may not have heard, with Jolene. I mean, this guy is a psycho, and
extreme.
He's the extreme. On the other hand, The vast majority of the evangelical movement, which adds up into maybe 30 million Americans, don't see people's sexuality that are gay as being a sin, as not deserving full rights within within this country. And, you know, it's easy. I mean, Phillips is easy because you go, whoa, this guy is such a freak.
Yeah.
That, but the idea that that you're trying to deny, not you, but that people are trying to deny people full participation in this society, that they have relationships based on love and commitment. Lots of them, you know, just some are, some aren't. You know, I mean, a lot of heterosexuals I know don't have. Anyway,
that's
I don't want to
right.
go there.
Yeah.
But your point is well taken.
Well
I
taken,
agree.
Absolutely.
Although I think we may have Matt in Chesterfield saying something similar. Matt, hey, it's Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan. You're on the air. Hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. Thanks.
I got a couple of things, actually, while I was on hold listening to your show. One thing, actually, what that fella just said, I completely agree with, and that's what I originally called to talk about.
But what about what I just said? That, yeah, so Phelps is the freak. On the other hand, you have these evangelical groups leading political campaigns against gays, saying that that homosexuality is an abomination. I mean, they have their right to their opinion.
I mean, let's talk about the last election. Yeah. You know, really.
Well, I understand that. And you know, your people have rights to their opinions and everything else, but they do not represent a majority of Christians or religious people. Period. You know,
well, I hope not.
Fortunately,
I always get. You know, I'm not going to lie, I'm leaning more towards the conservative side with most things, but, you know, it's hard to hear, you know, anytime I listen to a radio or talk show, you know, or not anytime, a lot of times when I listen, though, it always, people always talk about, you know, the evil Christians and everything else, and we're not included in that group. But there's actually another thing I wanted to say because I was...
Well, let me say this. This is thanks to George W. Bush. I mean, there wasn't a... Well, there's two things. One is that the desire of these fundamentalist Christian churches, beginning in the 1990s, to shape public policy, to be politically powerful, not to save souls. I mean, maybe they were doing that as well. Not to minister to people's spiritual needs, but to create public policy by virtue of their numbers and mobilizing people through the churches. So that had two effects. I mean, one that would the most important thing, it got people out to vote for conservative candidates, which was part of the Republican strategy. But it also had the effect of you're talking about Christians being demonized, is just at a point where gays are beginning to have the acceptance that they deserve in this society, like all people do, whether we agree with what they do in their own private lives and not hurting anybody or not. Suddenly these folks come along and start demonizing gays.
Okay, you know, there's different ends to that spectrum. There's the people that do that, and it's wrong, and then there's people who are on the exact opposite side of the spectrum, like Reverend Jesse Jackson and stuff like that, too. You know, and there's another thing I wanted to say, because you were talking about it while I was on hold, about the veterans and stuff like that.
Sure.
I am a veteran. I was in Iraq.
Yeah.
Oh, my.
And, you know, I hear... You know, first of all, it's offensive to me to hear, you know, to hear you guys say, oh, these, you know, 42-year-old mothers, you know, I work with some 42-year-old mothers that do a hell of a job and are very impressive with everything that they do.
I don't think it was about that. It was more about the fact that they upped the age so that they could get more people in because they just can't meet their goals.
It's desperation on the part of the Army that they had to, you know, the standards are have been incredibly loosened. And I'm not disparaging anybody. I'm saying that, listen, some of these generals are saying that the Army is about to break, which was the same thing they said at the end of the Vietnam War. Richard Nixon said, I'm not going to be the first American president to preside over a losing war. And his generals started telling him, and I don't think that's happening now, but he says, you're going to lose your army because they were starting to be, I mean, essentially what ended the war in Iraq was growing mutinies among the men, refusing to fight because they knew it was over. And sure enough, Henry Kissinger in 1972 was sitting in a room with the Chinese president saying, yeah, we know it's over and we've got to get a little time in between so we don't look real bad. Well, it must be. You must know, and every American knows, and every soldier in Iraq knows, that the war is over. It's just a matter of time before they get out of there, and it starts. The question starts being, who is going to be the last American or the last Iraqi to die for a policy that was absolutely a fool's errand at best and a pack of lies at worst?
Okay, I disagree, though. You know, first of all, as far as the troops are not against this like everyone thinks that they are. Everyone in my unit volunteered to go.
Yeah, well.
Nobody was forced to go, and we're not a bunch of ignorant.
Forced to go where?
Over to Iraq. All of us, every single person that went with me in my unit volunteered to go for the cause, and we've been there, and we know what it's like.
Well, I don't know what to tell you. I don't know how many are for and how many are against. That's not the point. And the point is that I don't even if anyone has an idea what the goals are here now, or if they believe anything that George W. Bush says, given that they have a pattern of lying and deception and changing goals. I'm sure that probably what's the big motivator is solidarity with fellow soldiers.
Well, here is a chance for you to be educated. Ask me a question and I will answer you.
Well,
and if I don't know.
How about this? What time is it? You know what it is? It's time for me to do commercials, and it's not dodging it. We'll talk another time. All right, because I'm late now. I'm sorry.
You're listening to WRIF.com. WRIF.com. WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, and welcome back. And please welcome Jolene Jordan, who's with me in the WRIF studios. Hi, Jolene.
Hi, Peter. Thank you.
Yes. 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. I told you I was going to start banging the Dems, the Democrats, as soon as they got it back, the House and the Senate back from these psycho, wacko, right-wing Republicans. And sure enough, now, the Democrats got in on a large part because they opposed the war in Iraq, and most Democrats and most people that voted for the Democrats want the U.S. to leave Iraq. All the Iraqis want us to leave. Something, I can't remember the figure, 60-70%, something like 85% of all the Sunnis want. The Red Crescent Society, it's like our Red Cross, just said that the main cause of their problems are American troops. So out now, out immediately. That's of course the most radical call, which I'm saying. But at least start setting a timetable for disengagement. And here is Harry Reid, the incoming Senate Majority Leader, Democrat from Nevada, saying that if the commanders on the ground want more troops, we're for it. So these guys, the Democrats, are so out of sync with the base that they are just the other part of the ruling racket.
Who was it that from, I think, the Senate who said we should send, was it McCain?
Yeah.
Send 30,000 more.
Yeah, where are they
going to
get 30,000? Get some more 42-year-old mothers.
There you go again, Peter.
I mean, they have people, like, I see these the ages of these people that have died. Some of them are like their late 40s.
Yeah. And you know what, that guy who called up before, and we were not disparaging women in their 40s.
No.
Believe me, I believe that women in their 40s can do anything.
40s power.
Yeah, 40s rule.
Yeah, okay. And let me see. What did I do with that? I had that thing that we just ran off where Colin Powell, maybe this is it. Oh, yeah, here. U.S. forces losing in Iraq. This is Colin Powell. This is the military architect, in part, of the first Gulf War. This is the guy that lied in the United Nations to get us into that as a tool of Bush and Cheney. And he said there really are no additional troops. Powell said, adding that he agreed with those who say the U.S. Army, quote, is about broken.
Okay, so for all of you who love Colin Powell, and there's a lot of you out there, now he's even saying.
Yeah, so it's not just some or a couple of wacky left-wing radicals on the air on WRF saying this. This is one of the foremost military leaders of the United States saying that there are no additional troops to send, and the U.S. Army is about broken.
It's very telling.
There you go.
Very
and here is Harry Reid, the Democrat, saying, yeah, well, I send 20,000 more in. Oh, man. All right. Where are we here? Let's go to Tim. Tim has been waiting patiently. Tim, it's Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan. Welcome.
Hey, Peter. Hey, Jolene. Can you hear me?
Sure.
Yeah, Tim.
Hi, I'm a Persian Gulf vet. I've been there twice. I agree with a lot of the stuff you've been saying. I believe that when we first went over there, we should have had 100,000 more troops initially. There needs to be a military draft. It's a bloodbath over there. There's no perimeter around Iraq. These insurgents are coming across the desert to fight us, and the number of insurgents has exploded. There's no way we can stop them. I think that Donald Rumsfeld is a coward that has blood on his hands. And our brave troops over there that are fighting are the best warriors we've ever had. And it just makes me sick what's happening. And I think that we need to just clean the slate, and everybody out there needs to vote Democrat, and we need to get a Democratic president in there. And they're always going to fight over there, and no matter what. And the weapons of mass destruction was a lie. I think that George Bush has really committed a lot of treasonous lies, acts to get
well, at least impeachable acts.
Yes, impeachable. And look what they did to Clinton over, you know, Monica Lewinsky, which was nothing. I mean, this guy has done, look what he's done to us.
Yeah, yeah.
And that comparison there should just tell you what's up, you know. And I just want to thank you guys for letting me talk on your show.
Well, Tim, thank you so much for joining us from Nova. I appreciate that. Can you say, I don't even know, can you say the BJ word out?
I think Drew and Mike do.
Do they?
I think so, but we probably don't need to.
Because I got a song on my website called Clinton Got a BJ, so they say it out. And that's the refrain. It's actually an absolutely incredible song. And it,
really?
Yeah, and it's got people.
Do you remember who does that, or is it just a parody type of thing?
Sort of a parody type of thing, it's really incredible. You go to Peter Werbe. W-E-R-B-E, peterwerbe.com. And you can also, in this video, you know, the refrain is, you know, Clinton got a BJ, like that. And you can send in yourself or you and others singing the refrain, and every once in a while they refresh the song by putting in people from all across the country.
I've got to do that when I find some time.
Yeah. So I don't know. I could play, but I like to keep broadcasting here.
You know what? I was pretty mad at Clinton back in the day, but now what he did is just so minor compared to what GW is doing.
I mean, I was mad at Clinton for being such a moron. I mean, on one hand, falling for that. I mean, I've probably heard me say this before, but first off, if a young intern started coming on to me and I was president of the United States, first thing I would think of would be, this is a setup by the Republicans.
First that, and
which
then what's the fallout, you know?
Yeah.
Because
you
always get caught.
Yeah, I was going to say, what do you think? Isn't going to come out? I mean,
please.
And then he should have said when they said, you know, what is, and he said, my personal life is none of your business between my wife and I. Get out of my face. Here's what I'm doing for public policy. Because the people didn't care about it. At the height of all this blue dress and all that, his popularity was 60%.
And where is Bush? 30%.
He's getting ready to drop into the 20s.
Well, and he will. You know, I think Hillary and that whole thing should have taken a little more of a fall for Bill. If she really loved him, she would have said we had a three-way.
Bill,
come on.
Bill could be back in the White House.
I know, as the first
man. Yeah. Maybe, but you know what I would like? You could get Obama and Bill. I would like that better.
Oh, sure.
Not Hillary.
Right. I know. No, I don't think she stands a very good chance.
She got a lot of money from that. All right, here's Eric in Belleville. Eric, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. Hi, you're on the air. Hey, Eric. Did I do something wrong here? Oh, I know. I got to push a button here.
Technical difficulties.
Yeah, my brain. Eric, hi. I'm sorry. It's Peter and Julian.
How you doing? How you doing tonight, Peter?
My apologies. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I just had a comment or whatever about, you know, there being no reason for the war or whatever. I guess just real soon we forget about 9/11. You know, there's plenty more people out there who would love to bring a dirty bomb over here.
Yeah, so
could I interject here? Yeah. Because 9/11 involved all Saudis. It was Saudi Arabia. Why didn't we go and invade them? It was not Iraqis. Do you know that?
Yeah, Iraq is a hotbed for it.
These guys were from Saudi Arabia. Why then do we just say, oh, okay, so it's the Middle East. We just group them in and stereotype them all and put them in one evil, you know, pocket?
Well, Eric, well, it actually was not a hotbed. It has become a hotbed because of the invasion.
Stirred the hornet's nest.
Yeah. It was like there was a hornet's nest outside, and we beat it with a stick, and then we brought it inside of the house. Because not only is it now a hotbed of people that hate the United States and will hate the United States for three generations to come, because the fact that the United States has killed over 600,000 Iraqi civilians, but also it has made us hated by Muslim people. people all around the world. So it's been an absolute disaster. And I never said there was no reason for the war. There's great reasons for the war, according to these twisted imperialists.
Halliburton.
Yeah, it's called Halliburton. It's called take the money that you and I make, Eric, and turn it over to the people that make war and then are supposed to be cleaning up after the war. But mostly it was to control oil very directly.
And to really make sure there's no middle class anymore.
Yeah, well, that's just one of the one of the fallout features, but also that to have U.S. forward bases to keep this worldwide military imperial system going, and also to be because of the understandable emotions around 9/11, to create a situation where the people of the United States would accept the government's ability to go to war anytime, anywhere, with no external constraints, law, international law, or anything like that. And all of it has been a catastrophic failure for Bush and his buddies. And it's, you know, the best thing that could be happened would be to sweep them entirely out of office. All right. Thank you so much.
He owed a lot of people favors for getting him into office, too.
That what?
Bush owed a lot of people favors.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, well, here, actually, I'm interested in this subject here. I mean, all your subjects. It's Holly from Waterford. Hi, Holly. It's Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan.
Hello, Peter. Hi, Jalene.
Hi.
I'm calling to find out. I haven't purchased a book by former President Carter, Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid.
Yeah.
And I was just trying to get your, I don't know, your view on it, or have you read it?
I have not read it. I would say it's kind of strange. Now, here everybody has this incredible respect for Jimmy Carter, and suddenly he says that the Israelis have been doing awful things to the Palestinians and essentially have an apartheid system similar to what that black South Africans experienced under the white Afghaners, you know, for, I don't know, what was it, 60, 70 years. And suddenly he's being denounced as an anti-Semite. Well, this is a subject that is never discussed, that the fact that there is another side of the Israeli-Palestinian question. Now, I have on my website, which I've only I mentioned a couple times, Peter Werby, W-E-R-B-E.
It's a good website.
It is. I mean, I just
chock full
copy and paste stuff, and there's a whole section about Israel. And very frequently, when you are critical of Israel, people, again, claim
automatically.
They say you're like anti-Semitic and stuff like that. But if you go to the site, you'll see that every single source on there is either from Israeli sources or American Jewish sources.
Tikkun.
Yeah. Like,
I am familiar with that, and I know also, too, that Carter is also an evangelical Christian.
Yeah.
And he speaks at a lot of their churches, which is kind of interesting, too.
Yeah, he's a. I'm much more critical of his presidency than a lot of people on the left are. But since then, he's become an extraordinary person, and all of his undertakings have been humanitarian. And most of the there's only one side of the Palestinian Israeli conflict ever shown in any full dimension, and one can argue the Israeli side if they choose. A lot of Israelis are as critical of their government, as critical of their policies as I am of ours, and yet that never has any expression in this country in the media at all. Because when you start, if you bring up criticism, like I say, you're not even answered. You're just said, you know, you're anti-Semitic, you're distorted, you're lying, you're what have you.
Exactly. Just like Haaretz newspaper in Israel. I know they get some people just stop their subscriptions over there for certain articles that they put out. I'm sure I think you've mentioned it before.
Haaretz newspaper, the Hebrew language, actually it has an English online version as well. And they frequently have articles that are extraordinarily critical of official Israeli policy towards the Palestinian. There is just now a group called, oh, I can't remember what it's called. I think it's called Break the Silence. And it's ex-Israeli soldiers who are coming forth and talking about essentially the crimes that they committed against the Palestinian people, the Palestinian civilian population, while they were either, you know, occupying Gaza and the West Bank, or during some of the military incursions.
That's true. Actually, I'm a Chaldean American, and I work in a hotel. And actually, one of my customers, a guest, was an ex-Israeli soldier. And, you know, we had quite a conversation. But I just wanted to get your opinion, and I don't want to take up all your time.
Well, let me just say something, because I'm not sure about, you know, and you're best to tell me, but I will say this regardless, is that people that don't know that Chaldeans are Christian Iraqis, right?
Yes, so exactly. You know, I like to say Iraqi. I have a lot of, here in Michigan, I'm not saying all the Chaldean people, but the majority want to separate themselves from the Muslim side of Iraq. You know, and I'm not like that. I have a lot of, I don't have a religion. I don't consider myself Christian.
Uh-huh.
You know, which is kind of a problem.
Well, the Chaldeans also were persecuted by Saddam Hussein.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, but also Tariq Aziz was one of his closest people.
Yeah, who's a Chaldean.
This is very weird, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate your call. Thanks,
Peter,
for having joined us.
We have a friend who has a T-shirt, David Rovics, DavidRovics.com, R-O-V-I-C-S. He has a T-shirt when we were down in South Florida doing a house concert, and it says, "We are all Palestinians." And there were some Jewish women in the room, and they said, "What does that mean?" You know, they were very upset by the T-shirt. But really, what he's saying is that we're all people. We're all people.
Mm-hmm.
And the Palestinian people are just trying to get through life like all of us are, but under these conditions that I just can't imagine.
Yeah, and if anyone is out there saying in their brains or yelling at the radio, what about the suicide bombers? I don't think any good-thinking, decent person accepts any attack on civilians.
Right.
And things like, although this includes suicide bombers as well, car bombs and suicide bombers are the poor man's F-14.
Yeah, that's right.
And so this is pretty, I mean, the suicide bombing seems, and car bombings, suicide bombings in cars seems particularly grotesque. It does to me. But, hey, you know what? Give the other side F-14s, and they would dispense with that. So any deaths of civilians, for no matter what the rationale is, just doesn't sit
we
well with me.
We denounce those, right?
We'll be right back.
This is WRIM.com.
Why?
WRIF.com. More Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, and joined by Jalene Jordan. Hi, Jalene.
Hi, Peter.
313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743, an open line, first one tonight, so if you've been trying to get through, please do. This hour, like last hour of Night Call, brought to you by Waking Up, Metro Detroit Sweatshop Free Clothing Store. It's located in the Universal Mall at 12 Mile Road in DeQuinder in Warren. And you can go to the WakingUpStore.com. No definite article there. WakingUpStore.com. I want to do this little feature here, and then we'll get back to the calls. You know what? Let me take some of these calls first, because for one thing, Mike is in Windsor, so thanks for making our call international. I don't want to keep you on the line too long. Go ahead, Mike.
Hey, Peter.
Hi.
Hi. I listen to you every week. I don't really agree with everything you have to say, but I like the show. It just brings up topics.
Thank you.
One thing I want your opinion on, I hope you'd agree with me, that your country definitely needs a third party to represent a lot of the people.
Well, unfortunately, yeah. I mean, something like the New Democratic Party in Canada, the NDP.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, if the unions, which now the Canadian trade unions are the financial backing of the NDP, and they've made some inroads, but here the unions here are just taking our money, in this case my money, and wasting it on the Democrats, giving them millions and millions and millions of dollars. And of course, if you get the Democrats in, at least they're not virulently anti-labor, anti-working people, middle class the way the Republicans are. But it sure takes a lot of money just to get back to zero. And that's where we are with the Democrats. And I suspect that the Democrat, because this whole system in the United States is based on blackmail in lots of different ways. And sort of the Democratic Party blackmail is that you don't have anybody else to vote for. So we can snuggle up to the corporations and we can try to get more conservatives or middle of the roaders from the Republicans if we don't act on the program that we say we're going to. Like, for instance, opposing the war. Now you have Senator Harry Reid saying, oh, yeah, I'd support more troops. Well, the people voted for you, you freak, Harry, not you, Harry Reid, because they want the U.S. out. So, yeah, so a third party. I mean, there's the Green Party here, and they I don't know if they get 1%.
What is Kucinich? He's running again, by the way.
Yeah, he's a Democrat in the Democratic primaries.
Right.
Yeah. Well, though, it would be interesting to break the monopoly. Here's the other part of the blackmail is that one of the criticisms that people support the Democratic Party, even people that are critical of the Democratic Party, they say if you vote for the Greens, it's a vote for the Republicans.
That's how I feel. And I mean, I am not a Democrat, but I voted, Democrat.
Well, that's what I mean. It's more blackmail.
Yeah,
you've got to vote for Debbie Stabenow, even though she's made all these terrible votes at this year trying to look middle of the road.
They had terrible TV ads for her. They had that cardboard cutout. Did you ever see it?
No.
Oh, that poor woman.
Yeah. I didn't want to do this, though. I have this thing. Remember, we were always talking about we were going to do features.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I don't. Maybe our production ace, John, remember, who's coming back from Florida?
Yes.
Yeah. Maybe
we could hire him.
Yeah.
No, for free.
Yeah, for free. All right. So here's a few things in this rich and poor. Mortgage delinquencies are a rising threat. This is mortgage delinquency and foreclosure rates are on the rise, and the impact would be greatest on low-income families, do you think?
Yeah, really.
That took out higher interest loans for risky borrowers. That's a hard one to say, borrowers.
Yeah, you get that. It's very deceiving. You get that low rate, and then slowly it creeps up till you can't afford it anymore.
Yeah. And all right, then how about this from the New York Times? At $300 a bottle, do you have to tip? Roberto Cavalli, the Italian fashion designer, knows a thing or two about catching someone's eye, and his new vodka was making an impression on a recent Friday night at the glitzy Y Bar in Chicago. The bottle, which sells for $60 in stores and around $300 in the VIP lounges and clubs like the Y Bar, glowed on its own light stand, lending a green hue to its slender shape. April Sargent, a customer, leaned forward from her couch, ran a finger along the bottle's embossed serpent coiled around its middle and its silver snakehead spout. She said, I like it.
Oh, God.
So here.
That's called excess worse.
Yeah. You know what that's called? Actually, over 100 years ago, there was an early American sociologist. What the hell is his name? Weber or Veblen? One or the other. There's two of them. But he talked about conspicuous consumption, that it wasn't even to get like the best. You didn't want to consume in order to have the best couch.
Okay.
Right? You wanted to consume so it was conspicuous to people that could see that what you had represented wealth.
Ah,
yeah.
Okay.
So if you're spending $300,
hey, just give me some Smirnoff at $10 a pint or whatever. I don't know.
So while the middle class, I got a better one here for this. The 2004 income in the U.S. was below the 2000 level. So even though, you look in some of our neighborhoods and people are putting on additions and all of that, despite significant gains in 2004, the total income Americans reported to the tax collector that year, adjusted for inflation, was still below the peak in 2000. So Bush has been driving down the average wage of Americans. And here you got all these rich people just getting richer and richer, getting more and more money, more and more tax breaks, and still we're making less.
Yeah, times are hard, I tell you.
Not everyone. Morgan Stanley gave Chief Executive Officer John Mack the biggest bonus for the head of a Wall Street firm ever, awarding him $40 million as the company headed for the best profits in its 71-year history.
Wow.
So
that's quite a bonus. I mean, most people just want $100, for Christmas or the holidays or whatever.
Here's one of my favorites, though. Well, 1 in 32 Americans are in jail or on parole.
Okay.
So here, Hundreds of
that nurses, whole racket, right, yeah. Peter?
This is last week, right. Hundreds of nurses were turned away on Monday when they reported for work at two hospitals in Las Vegas as management began what officials say will be at least a five-day lockout over failed contract negotiations.
Mm.
Now, what happened on a lockout is that if the workers decide they're not getting a contract, they'll strike. Well, also, what employers can do, they'll say, if you won't sign a labor contract with you, we're locking you out. We won't let you work here.
So some bully tactics going on there. Yeah.
But temporary nurses were brought in to cover shifts, and the hospitals were functioning normally, according to the guy running the things. The conglomerate, oh, wait a minute. I'm sorry. This is the important part of it. Temporary nurses were brought in to cover shifts, and the hospitals were functioning normally, said Steve Filton, chief financial officer for United Health Services, the conglomerate based in King of Prussia, Pennsylvania, that owns Valley and Desert Springs Hospital in the urban core of Las Vegas. So this is a big for-profit enterprise.
Yeah.
It's not about making people well. It's about making profits. So they want to drive down the cost of labor. Right? That's the variable cost. The fixed cost is the x-ray machine. You can't get that cheap. But you can drive down the cost of labor by driving down our wages. And that's connected up. Remember, we always talk on our show about connecting the dots.
Yeah.
That's what's happening. Our wages are being driven down, which provides more profits for United Health Services in King of Prussia, Pennsylvania.
Just all backwards.
Which is a rest stop, by the way.
Oh.
On the Pennsylvania Turnpike.
Oh.
The SEIU, the Service Employees International Union, which represents the nurses, had called for a strike to start Monday, but they preempted them. United Health Services said that they enacted its strike contingency plan in the form of a lockout. The plan involved flying in and housing hundreds of nurses hired from the U.S. Nursing Corporation based in Denver, which supplies nurses to hospitals involved in labor disputes.
Oh, well, isn't that just convenient?
So you have a company that is
spending all this money
to house them.
It just makes no sense.
Well, during the newspaper strike 10 years ago in Detroit from 2005 to 2000, the newspapers spent millions and millions of dollars on strike breakers and goon squads and Pinkerton detectives and all of that. Also, they wouldn't have to give their workers a raise.
Mm.
That would have been. So you have a company that is based on supplying what they call scab labor,
right?
And so he said the lockout nurses, we've told them they come back on Saturday, absent any further strike of threats. They insisted the quality of health care was not suffering. A locked out nurse disagreed. Temporary nurses don't know the system. They don't know where the supplies are. Maybe they're working in specialties they're not familiar with. I imagine it's not very safe in there. I mean, how would you like to be a patient where you're having nurses flown in? Again, they're not interested in caring for the sick. They're interested in strike breaking and getting an incredible amount of money. Because, I mean, say, I don't know, let me see if you think this through. Like $1,000 a week for a nurse. They'll get like $3,000.
That's just so twisted.
Let's see. At 1 a.m. Eastern time, we're going to be airing an interview with. Bong.
Did you conduct the interview this week?
I did. It was with a man.
Okay.
He was on the telephone. Oh yeah, John Ross.
Did he write a book?
He wrote a book about the Zapatistas, the Mayan-based rebel movement in southern Mexico. But he also talks about the effect that it has on Detroit. I said, what? How the hell could Indian rebels?
Tie that in.
NAFTA. NAFTA. Oh, it's all about NAFTA.
Okay.
So we'll talk about that at 1 a.m. Also, the ex-police chief of Seattle. It's an extraordinarily interesting interview.
Sure.
All right. Let's, we've had some people here for a long time. John is way up in Flint, the home of the labor movement. Kind of long gone, though. John, Peter and Jolene, you're on the air.
Hey, Peter and Jolene, nice to meet you.
Thank you.
You too.
You bring up so many good subjects. I was calling about Iraq, but as a healthcare provider, I have to say, with the nurses thing, they went through that at a hospital up here. And they're jack-of-all-trades, masters of nothing, and they throw them in all these different floors. And
sure.
And neonatal units and all that. They don't know what they're doing.
Well, I wouldn't be comfortable at all.
Yeah, they did that up in Petoskey as well. And I don't ever know what happened, whether that strike won or lost. Maybe someone can tell us. But go ahead.
Yeah. So it's, you know, it is true that the patient care goes down. But I worked in Iraq for a subcontractor of KBR, which is Halliburton. But
right.
They made the subsidiary, so if anything goes wrong and they get sued, they can spin it off and,
sure.
and lose liability.
People got to remember, too, that's Cheney's company. Cheney still gets money every year from Halliburton from his retirement. But go ahead.
Yes. Well, I was over there. People were getting paid $80,000 a year to watch local nationals get paid $10 a day to clean toilets. And
what a racket.
Yeah, and people don't understand. I mean, you know, a lot of poor people go over there and make a lot of money, but at the bottom line, they charge three times the labor. How much money is Halliburton pulling in on top of bonuses that they don't deserve? When they get busted for overcharging, they overcharge for everything.
Sure.
I mean, it's sick, and people just, they're complacent.
Yeah.
And don't even understand it.
Well, I think if you say, in fairness, John, that if you said to people Halliburton, people probably do not have a good opinion. But one of the things is that we are, up until this change of who controls Congress, we had no manner to protest all of this. Now, people like Patrick Leahy of New Hampshire, Vermont, which is it? Vermont, isn't it? Yeah. The senator that's going to be doing investigations of all of this, and Henry Waxman of California is going to be head of the committee that's going to be investigating all the cost overruns and provide oversight. The scandals that are, I mean, if these Democrats do their job, and normally they don't, so this will be an abnormal state of affairs if the Democrats actually are up to the task. But it's extraordinarily important that they do that. All right, thank you very much. 313-298-WRIF. And here is a surprise for Jalene Jordan, who's with me, because it's our old pal, Roy from Placitas, New Mexico. Roy.
Oh, Roy.
Good afternoon. It is so good to hear that bubbly, outrageous, outrageous, wonderfully enthusiastic voice with you, Peter.
Oh, I thought you were talking about me. You're talking about Jerome.
Oh, heck no. No boring stick in the mud.
Thank you, Roy. You're sweet.
I was going to call, and then when they got on to talking about the fundamentalist, I just had to call in and chime in, because I grew up with that bunch.
Yeah.
My mother still kicks in her $25 to Pat Robertson every week.
Wow.
Really?
She hasn't caught
every
on.
Every month.
She hasn't caught on, huh?
And, I mean, there is no logic to their rationale, or there is no rationale to their logic. It is just absolutely insane. And the reason that I really prompted my call is there's a controversy kind of hitting a little bit. There's a video put out by one of the fundamentalist groups that was filmed in the Pentagon that stars four generals and three colonels, or vice versa,
yeah.
testifying, testimony, preaching their faith, and promoting this group.
Over one religion and one sector of one religion over all the others.
That's right. Yeah. And these guys are upper echelon. These people have their fingers on the buttons.
Yeah, aren't they all about...
Like Mikey Weinstein was saying, you know, this just plays into the hands of the Middle Easterns.
Who's Mikey Weinstein?
Mikey Weinstein is the fellow who sued the Air Force
Academy
because they were... harassing his sons while they were going there.
Oh, he was a Jewish American, and they were giving him a hard time.
Yeah, and he lives here in Albuquerque. And Weinstein was on Reagan's legal staff in the White House. He's still a registered Republican.
Wow.
He used to donate to Heather Wilson here in Albuquerque. He jumped ship this year and backpacked to Madrid because...
You got rid of Heather Wilson, didn't you?
No, we came within 143 votes.
Oh,
543 votes, something like that.
Yeah.
It was a heartbreaker. But the whole thing with this underground religious fundamentalist wackos, very, very, very strong in the Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
But they have...
And at the Air Force Academy. That's where that all went down with Mikey Weinstein's son.
Have you interviewed him?
I haven't, but maybe I should. You know,
just came out with a new book.
Oh, yeah. Well, Mikey or his son?
Mikey Weinstein.
Mikey. All right. Mikey.
And...
is he a grown man still?
I know it is.
I just keep thinking, Mikey, that old ad, Mikey will eat it.
Yeah.
Hey. There's a story behind it, but I forget. And he's an impressive interview. He's a good
all right. Well, I'll think about that. All right, Roy, give us our.
Have a good one.
Wait.
You guys have a great holiday.
Wait. Okay. Give us your usual sign off. What should we do?
Agitate, motivate, educate.
And what else?
And keep on tapping.
Keep on tapping.
Oh, yeah, keep tapping.
Do you remember he tried to cure? Oh, I have to tell Roy this, that he tapped. Tapping is a form of, like meditations to try to get rid of habits or certain things like that. Well, I was addicted to Coke Classic, and he tapped.
Coca-Cola Classic.
Yeah.
Right.
And he tapped me on the air.
Yeah.
And so it was a delayed effect, but I don't drink it anymore. But it's for political reasons that I don't drink it.
Well, Coke is the drink of
the
Death
Squads.
David Rovics.
Yeah, check it out.
Yeah.
We sound crazy, but we're not.
I know. I wish I could sing. Oh, yeah, remind me, we got to play your album.
Sure.
To your CD.
My song.
Now, wait a minute, though. Let me see. Tapping. Yeah. Our pal and colleague, Tom Hartman, the
author and
national
talk show host,
he has a new book out called Walking Your Blues Away. And and part of it has to do with the, why can't I even remember anything anymore? About, I keep thinking bipolar.
Oh, ADD is what he talks a lot about.
He talks about how people would actually used to cure by this tapping method. I'm in over my head.
Okay.
I'm in over my head.
Does he believe it? Okay, so he's for this.
Yeah.
Well, it works for me. It was just took a couple of years after I was tapped.
Just put in tapping into your Google. It's
very interesting.
And see what comes up. All right, where are we here? Here is Kathy. Kathy's in Southgate. Hi, Kathy. It's Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan. You're on the air.
Thank you. I had both a comment and a question. My comment is that I get a little worn out of Americans referring to the Middle East as a place that just does not want to settle, and they've been in war for thousands of years, not realizing the current conflict that is going on between Israel and Palestinian and the surrounding peoples. It was started by the UN in 1948 with the division of land, and I really wish Americans would educate themselves before they start throwing that around. My question is for you, Peter. I imagine you've heard of the Council of Foreign Relations.
Sure.
And what is the group that superseded it and was established by Gandhi Rockefeller in the 70s, and it, instead of just being an American high echelon manipulative group, it now involves the high upper echelon worldwide. And do you think this is still having an influence, and is this really the underground that is running the show and trying to take away the middle class in America and pull strings worldwide?
Well, Kathy, as you could tell earlier, I couldn't barely remember the name of my guest. So trying to remember, there's any number of associations where the wealthy elite and their political operatives get together to plan out policy. So a lot of the decisions, even in the most democratic of countries, and the United States is not one of the more democratic ones, is ruled primarily, the command decisions are made behind the scenes by the elite. And they group together. Sometimes they have just what they call a social association, something like the Bohemian Grove Club that meets every year or so out in San Francisco. Or they have the Club of Rome, or they have the Council on Foreign Relations that are trying to direct their particular national economies or the world economy in a way that benefits them the most. They ostensibly will talk about how it's going to do well for everyone, but it doesn't wind out to be that way. In fact, here, this article from the Financial Times, no radical paper to be sure, Personal wealth is distributed so unevenly across the world that the richest 2% of adults own more than 50% of the world's assets, while the poorest half, which is about 3 billion people, own 1% of the wealth. So you have this concentration of wealth to such a degree that the lives of billions of people are distorted through poverty and disease and war and what have you. There's enough wealth to every on this world to feed all of the problems that we take for granted, like poverty, like disease, like wars. And yet, because of the desire of these people to continue this obscene and absurd amount of wealth in the hands of such a small number of people, that the situation continues. Let me see. I'm trying to just look quickly. It's the world's wealth is concentrated in so few hands that if all the world's wealth was distributed evenly with each person, that we'd have $20,500. So, I mean, that includes little babies and what have you. And, I mean, in a way, that's crazy. People say, oh, you're going to take away my mind. You know, I have $50,000 of wealth. You're going to redistribute it. I'm only going to have 20. That's not what we're talking about. That there's enough here. For not that none of this that we see in front of us has to occur. And let me see, 90% of the world's wealth is held in North America, Europe, and high-income Asian and Pacific countries such as Japan and Australia. North America has 6% of the world's adult population, accounts for 34% of household wealth. And the argument, I can imagine, some people say, yeah, we're going to keep it like that because if we share it with everybody, we're going to be poor. Again, that's not the that's not exactly what's going on. No one, the idea is not to take money away from people other than the ultra wealthy. I mean, Bill Gates can't even give it away, and I mean he doesn't.
He tries.
He can't do it. All right, let's continue. Kathy, thanks sir for bringing that up. Maybe someone will remember what the Rockefeller inspired group you're talking about.
Google it.
Yeah. Here's an old pal as well. It's Watts from Detroit. Watts, it's Peter and Jolene on WRIF. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. Hi, Jolene.
Hi.
Hi, Watts.
First of all, I was wondering if you could, a lot of folks still don't know the details that the Bush administration kept from the Democrats for the vote on the war on Iraq, if you could go into that.
Wait. I missed that. I think we both missed that.
Oh, sorry.
Did you miss it, Jolene?
Yeah.
Okay, me too.
Okay, yeah, some people still don't know the details that the Bush administration kept from the Democrats for the vote for the war on Iraq.
Yeah.
If you could go through that a little bit.
To ask the question is to answer it. They didn't give full information to the Democrats within the Congress, which is probably another crime that ought to be added to the bill of particulars for the impeachment of Bush.
Yeah, that really, I don't think has been under the microscope as much as it should be.
But you know what? Hillary Clinton knew there were no weapons of mass destruction. John Edwards knew there were no weapons of mass destruction.
I think most of them.
Yeah, John Kerry, and this is all Democrats who voted for the war resolution. They knew there were no weapons of mass destruction.
They were afraid to have a dissenting opinion. Our gal Cynthia McKinney, she was right there in it.
Yeah,
voted against it.
The majority of Democrats voted against the war resolution. Because they knew, not only did they know there were no weapons of mass destruction, they knew if the inspectors were given the chance to finish their inspection of Iraq in 2002, that they would in fact find that there were no weapons of, early 2003, they would find out that there were no weapons of mass destruction, and it would mean that Bush was lying.
Right.
And I was wondering, when you go on vacation, could you please have like the best of Werby or a guest speaker or something along those lines? Because it's
Wait. Before you say anything that might even be turn out to be a little mean.
What?
Okay. Well, go ahead. What were you going to say?
No, I was saying when you go on vacation or something, if you could have like the best of Werby or something.
I am going to have the best of Werby, Jolene Jordan.
All right. Wow, okay.
And just so he knows, and anyone, I've filled in for you before. In fact,
great.
Peter used to do CNN and NBC, and he decided he didn't like to do that TV thing anymore. So I filled in for you. I did all of that. Yeah.
Great. That's great news.
All right, Watts. Thank you very much. Thanks for joining us at 313-298-WRIF. We'll be right back.
This is WRIF.com. Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werb.
Thank you very much. Our final segment for tonight, Jalene Jordan is with me. And, you know, I should have been announcing all along, Jalene, this is the last show of the year.
It is.
Well, because December 24th, next week, is
I'll be
Christmas
in here
Eve.
Christmas Eve. Because I don't celebrate, and Doug Podell knows it.
Are you doing my show?
I'm not. I will be on doing just regular programming music.
Oh, okay.
And then New Year's Eve, I'll be on from
you're going to be on New Year's
8
Eve?
P.m. till 2 in the morning. I'll be ringing in the Motor City, Peter. It's an honor.
We were having a party at our house. No, we're not. We're
no,
not.
You're not.
I'm not going to like that. You know, I'm trying to think that there was come by after 2.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. You know, there was, I'm trying to think of this. There was a guy here at WRF, Greg, what the hell is his name? Greg St. James. Yeah, Greg St. James. And he gave up drinking and found religion.
Mm.
And so I was supposed to work New Year's, and he was supposed to work Christmas. So I said, since I'm on the reverse track... How about if we switch?
Did he go for it?
He did. He didn't like it, though. I don't know. He got,
that's good,
yeah,
Peter.
He got insulted for that.
Oh.
Here's Jason in Ypsilanti Township. Jason, it's Peter and Jalene. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Peter.
Hi.
Great show tonight.
Thank you.
I really appreciate everything you do. It's just I'm sure everyone does. I guess I just wanted to make a comment. I try not to get too technical about it, I guess, but something that affects us all, I think, and has to do with the war in Iraq and everything, I think most people know that it wasn't a war for democracy, and it probably wasn't for any good reason other than to kind of maintain the status quo of how things are with America... kind of controlling the rest of the world.
Okay.
We're number one.
Number one.
Yeah, I know. And I don't want to get too technical about it, but I guess the thing I would tell people is, right, you know, ever since we kind of left the old economic system we used to have, which, you know, back in the Nixon era, we've relied on oil to give value to our currency. And the whole... trade in oil and everything, if we don't, you know, keep using oil and keep control of oil, we don't have control of kind of the financial system of the world. And I think that's a big reason.
Sure.
Because we used to produce the most oil. In 1970, the United States was the number one oil producer in the world.
Is that right?
But it's not anymore. Hmm.
No, we produce a lot of oil, but not anywhere near. I don't even know what the hell we are.
Well, we're down there now.
We're down there.
Tenth,
yeah.
Or something. I mean, it's just not, and it's not, and we use most of what we, you know, we don't export anymore, and we don't even produce half of what we use, so we can't control the markets. Like,
well, and the idea that the Republicans have to go into these ecologically sensitive areas like the Alaska or offshore, that's great.
And they want to export.
Yeah. Yeah, but the Alaskan oil.
Yeah, so yeah. Like Japan, I think.
Right.
It's ridiculous.
Well, I think there's one thing I would say is there's two rules to really unregulated capitalism, and one everyone knows is making a profit, and the other one is maintaining the conditions to make a profit.
Uh-huh.
And that's what this war is about, in my opinion.
Well, on the other hand, though, it's driving the United States into such severe debt. I can't imagine that the big capitalists are going for this. I suppose the short-run advantages to them through being able to feed at the trough is inviting. But a lot of economists think we're on the road to ruin.
Well, we're in big trouble. Again, I don't want to get into a bunch of numbers, but the housing crunch you were talking about comes from deregulating the markets, and a lot of these firms, they make all these mortgages, and they make the profit, but they pass on the risk to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. They sell these loans right to them. They do all these things so that...
Those are not soul singers, people.
No.
Those are federal agencies. Yeah.
Government. Yeah. But I guess just to make a final point... a lot of the debt that is being created isn't, you know, Bush isn't in debt and his buddies aren't in debt. We're in debt.
Yeah.
And so we're responsible for it. Banks, the banking system wants debt, you know, because that's control. You know,
sure.
They always have way more money, and basically they have institutional control. Even if the size of these big corporations goes down, they're still going to control the institution. So that's what they're trying to maintain, ultimately.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much for joining us. And I was reaching for a story that somewhere now my pile is just...
Get your gas at Citgo. I just want to throw that in. We're talking about oil.
All right.
Gas. Because it's Venezuelan oil. And, you know, it's so funny when I tell people that I only get my gas at Citgo because, you know, you informed me,
yeah.
Mr. Werby. Oh, wait.
Hey, that's my
dad.
Sorry.
Yeah, that's your dad. Sorry. They say, well, Chavez, huh? You're going to support him. Well, you know, the fact is that some of the profits go to the poor.
Yeah.
And then I hear, well, they're all poor. They keep them poor. Well, okay, whatever. I would rather buy Venezuelan oil than Middle East oil, period.
Actually, there's been, I don't know if it's in Latin America or whatever, but there's this disease of blindness that through the use of these oil profits that Venezuela has virtually wiped out.
Oh, yeah, those bastards. Can we say that?
Yeah, I guess. It's after midnight. We can even play the Clinton Got a BJ song.
We need to talk to programming.
Right. Yeah,
we can play that.
We will. Here, this is from the Lansing State Journal. Michigan's rate of return on tax dollars makes us a donor state. Now, think about this, folks. We are a state with economic problems because of all the bright guys at the oil, at the auto companies and what have you. But here, for every tax dollar Michigan residents send to Washington, we get back a maximum of 88 cents in federal spending on programs ranging from Medicaid to highway construction. So it's like a slot machine, right? You know, they tell you right on it. I don't know. They have that in Michigan where on the slots they tell you how much it'll return. It'll say returns 92 cents.
Oh, I don't know. I'm not much of a gambler.
Well, me neither. But you play it for you play a dollar for what essentially telling you. You play a dollar for an hour and you get 92 cents back. What a deal.
What a deal.
Yeah. The state's donor status is evident in the poor condition of many Michigan roads and the lower reimbursement rates Medicaid pays to doctors in the state. So we're paying here. We're now getting to be a poorer state, and we're paying more than we're getting back. So essentially, we're being looted
once again.
Sweet.
Nice deal.
All right, we're talking about gas. Here's Reno in Melvindale wants to talk about gas. In fact, you're right down there where those big holding tanks are, aren't you, Reno?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Yeah, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, listen, man. Hey, I'm in the middle of the mix, man. I mean, a couple years back when East Coast went out and we got a blackout, if
right.
you will. Yeah. And you know what? It's pretty scary stuff, man.
What?
It's pretty
what?
Scary stuff.
What is?
I think the whole situation, right?
Yes, absolutely, man. I mean, the scary stuff, they evacuated a neighborhood. They evacuated a town, actually.
Yeah, I was in the middle of the woods camping during that. I didn't even know it happened, and it made me appreciate not even being here, you know?
Yeah, you know what? I mean, if you're in the mix of a fire department and a police force coming through your neighborhood, scaring you out of there, getting the hell, forgive my French, but getting gone. It's scary stuff, but the gas prices.
Yeah, tell me about the gas prices. They're going up. They're going up.
Yeah.
Are they?
A little bit.
What do you think is driving it, man? What do you think, man? I mean,
greed. Greed of the oil companies that they're making these record profits. All right, I'm going to take these calls a little quicker, so thank you for yours, Reno. I appreciate it.
Very scary stuff.
Yes.
I agree.
Here's Jim in Dearborn. Jim, hi. You're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi.
You were talking about Debbie Stabenow before, and I know Carl Levin just said he's going to run again in 2 years.
That's right.
And, I mean, his record isn't much better than hers when you look at what he's voted for and what he said.
Yeah, he voted again. Well, so did she. We started calling her Debbie Stabasol. but He voted, both of them voted against the war resolution, but you know, they're maneuvering the way they the best they can in order to make themselves the most attractive candidates.
But I mean, like last year when they redid the Patriot Act, he was saying how important it was for the country to have the Patriot Act.
Yeah.
And then at Gates for Defense, he says, well, he was involved in Iran-Contra. He lied to Congress when he was up to the CIA, but I'm going to vote for him for Defense Secretary.
Sure.
And it's like, well, I mean, what is he doing there?
Well, what he's doing is, and what Debbie Stabenow did and what Kerry and Hillary and all the rest of those Democrats did, they don't want that thrown back at them during a... During an election. Yeah. So they're willing to sell out their constituents, sell out the country in order to ensure that they'll get reelected so they can, what? You know?
Greasy politicians. They're just greasy.
All right. Thanks, Jim. I agree with you. Let's see. Here is Scott in Birmingham. Scott, hi. You're on the air. Oh, wait a minute. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Peter, I hate to get hyper-technical on you, but when we call the vote for the war resolution, a vote for the war, we're falling into the Fox News speak and the Bush administration talking points who essentially want to spread around responsibility for the disaster that's going on in Iraq. And the war resolution was nothing but a resolution giving the president authority to use military force in Iraq should two conditions be met. First condition, of course, was to enforce the UN resolutions. The second one was if it's necessary to defend the national security of the United States. And we all know that condition was never met.
Right.
So the sole responsibility is on the president.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. But it still is, I mean, if people that had the prestige that some of the Democratic senators had, if they would have had a united party vote against against Bush, and every, like I say, every one of them, I mean, if people like me knew that there were no weapons of mass destruction, certainly those senators did as well. And every one of them that says, well, they saw intelligence and all that, they're lying. They
what they did is they passed the buck. They abdicated their responsibility.
They did. They did.
Yeah, they were cowards.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's about the long and the short of it. Scott, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Let's go to Al. Al is in Inkster. Al, hi. You're on the air.
How are you two doing tonight?
We two are doing good.
Yeah.
Well, I shouldn't speak for Jalene.
Wonderful.
Good. Me too. Yeah.
I was doing good until I heard you could be a professional scab. Exactly how far down on the human evolutionary scale do you have to slide before you can do that for a living?
Yeah, we're talking. Let me just remind people. There was this hospital strike of nurses in Las Vegas, and there is this firm that does nothing. That does nothing except provide strike breakers, which are called scabs, to hospitals that need replacement workers that go into a community of which they're not part of, take the jobs, and intervene on the side of the bosses.
For three times the amount of money.
Yeah.
That's nurturing and very healthy.
Yeah. Exactly.
That's what they've done. The Bush administration has declared war on labor, and they've so twisted the NLRB that, speaking of nurses, a recent decision out of Macomb County stripped nurses who, you know, their lead nurses or, you know, whatever, they do a little, you know, tell people what to do and make sure everything gets done.
Oh, like the charge nurse.
Charge nurse. They stripped them of their, they can no longer be in a union. They're now considered to be management.
Wow.
Hmm.
Well, here, Jack London, who wrote To Light a Fire, and what's his famous book? I can't remember. But here's what he wrote. After God had finished, now, everyone who's not in the labor movement doesn't know this phrase, but a scab is a strike breaker. When there's a strike going on, they take someone's job. This is what Jack London said. After God had finished the rattlesnake, the toad, and the vampire, he had some awful substance left with which he made a scab. A scab is a two-legged animal with a corkscrew sole, a water brain, a combination backbone of jelly and glue. Where others have hearts, he carries a tumor of rotten principles. When a scab comes down the street, men turn their backs and angels weep in heaven, and the devil shuts the gates of hell to keep him out. No man or woman has a right to scab so long as there is a pool of water to drown his carcass in or a rope long enough to hang his body with. Judas was a gentleman compared with a scab. For betraying his master, he had character enough to hang himself. A scab has not. I don't know who this is. Esau, E-S-A-U, sold his birthright for a... Oh, is it? Okay. Sold his birthright for a mess of pottage. Judas sold his savior for 30 pieces of silver. Benedict Arnold sold his country for a promise of a commission in the British Army. The scab sells his birthright, country, his wife, his children, and his fellow men for an unfulfilled promise from his employer. Esau was a traitor to himself. Judas was a traitor to his God. Benedict Arnold was a traitor to his country. A scab is a traitor to his God, his country, his family, and his class.
That's true.
It puts it right in a nutshell for you.
Yeah, so anybody that does that, that works, and that goes for all the scabs that took jobs from the newspaper workers here between 2000 and 2005 and all of that. But I just unceremoniously said goodbye to Al.
You know what? I heard Drew and Mike do that the other day, and they just said, call back. Don't feel too bad. It happens. Technical difficulties happen.
Al, don't call back.
Call in, what, 3 weeks?
That's 3 weeks, yeah, because there's no show Christmas Eve or New Year's Eve.
Right.
Yeah.
We're rocking, baby.
Yeah, I'm going to be rocking. Right. And you can still go to my website. I'll have some interviews on there if you want to hear more. So it's Peter Werbe, WERBE.com.
You know, you could spend days on that website, on your website.
Oh, yeah.
Full of information.
I thought you were going to say spelling it over and over again. Next time, I don't know what I think I would have my website be nightcall.com.
Oh, yeah.
Because
yeah.
I won't have to keep spelling my name. All right, but why don't we do this? Why don't we play a Jolene Jordan song?
Let's do it,
You can go to JoleneJordan.com,
right.
And everyone spells your name wrong, so it's J-U-L-I-N-E, like it's Jew-line, right?
Yeah.
And
J-O-R-D-A-N.
It's cut six, right?
I believe so. This is terrible. I don't even know the own order of my songs on the CD, but this one includes Vinny from Sponge. Most anyone who lives in Detroit knows who Vinny is, and he was kind enough to sing on this song. You know, he has a song called The Man on his most recent Sponge release, and the basic premise of it is the man, he talks to God, he's going to kill.
Wow.
And I remember when I heard it, when it was being engineered and produced and all that jazz in the studio, we recorded it at the same studio. I said, you know, that's about Bush, isn't it? And I thought, you know what? I liked Vinny before. Now I love Vinny. But he was sweet enough to do this song with me. He came in, did it in 10 minutes, and we were off to have martinis and sushi.
Oh, good. All right. Here's the album. The album is What She Said.
Yeah.
Jolene Jordan. You go to JoleneJordan.com. And we have something else keeps going through my brain. Oh, yeah. So at 1 a.m., just in about 9 minutes or so, interview with John Ross, speaking about the situation in Mexico, how it affects us here in Detroit. And
the Zapatistas.
The Zapatistas, yeah. And then the ex-police chief of Seattle, Washington. And then at 2 a.m.,
then it's me.
Riff Rock and Roll with Jolene Jordan.
All the way up into the best of Drew and Mike at 6 a.m.
Yeah, so have a wonderful holiday season, whatever you're celebrating or nothing. And have a great new year, and I'll talk to you. What would it be? What would the date be? Like the 6th, January 6th or something?
Right
like
around
that.
There.
Oh, I'm going to miss you. All right, here's Jolene Jordan on WRIF.
WRKF.com. More Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. A pleasure to be with you. I suspect, I hope I'm wrong, people. I hope I'm wrong when I say this. But I think a lot of Americans, when they think of Mexico and the citizens of Mexico, Mexicans, right now, probably the biggest point of reference in their mind is illegal immigration. Well, Mexico is a huge populous country. It's in North America, and there's a lot more going on than the several hundred thousand people that have left horrible conditions in Mexico to try to get ahead here in the United States. Extraordinarily important book has come out recently. It's picks up where another one left off. It's written by John Ross. It's called Zapatistas. And if that doesn't ring any bells, it will soon. The subtitle is Making Another World Possible, Chronicles of Resistance, 2000 to 2006. And John Ross, this is his eighth published work of fiction and nonfiction. And he's also published his highly praised autobiography, Murdered by Capitalism, 150 Years of Life and Death on the U.S. Left. And he has written numerous other books, including ones about Mexico. He's been a contributor to the San Francisco Bay Guardian, the Texas Observer, lots of other ones as well. He's lived in the old quarter of Mexico City for the past 20 years. John Ross is now in San Francisco, where we're talking with him. Welcome to the Peter Werbe Show.
Hi, how are you doing, Peter?
And although this is certainly 101, I think we may have to do this. For those who are thinking Zapatistas and scratching their head, give us a thumbnail sketch of who we're talking about here.
Well, the Zapatista Army of National Liberation, the EZLN by its initials, rose in rebellion against the Mexican government in 1994 in the very first hour of the North American Free Trade Agreement, basically as a reaction to the impending inundation of U.S. corn into Mexico, U.S. and Canadian corn. Much of it transgenic corn, much of it genetically modified corn that has indeed flooded the country and will increase in the coming years. In 2008, all tariffs on corn and beans will be removed. And basically the Zapatistas saw back in 1994 that what NAFTA was going to do to them, they are Mayan Indians, and Mayans are, by designation of their sacred book, the Chilambalam and the Popol Vuh, are the people of the corn. They're made from corn, according to the sacred books. And they saw that this inundation, which is now about between 6 and 8 million tons a year, was going to displace them from the internal market and, in fact, end their abilities to stay on the land. Unfortunately, that's pretty much what's happened. Here we are 12 years down the pike, 13 years down the pike from the advent of the North American Free Trade Agreement. And, you know, there was a study done in 1993, excuse me, by a professor from UCLA, Raul Hinojosa, for the Mexican Agricultural Secretariat, which gave a worst-case scenario of 10 million farmers being forced off the land by this cheap corn from the U.S. And Mexico corn is very labor-intensive. Sometimes the farmer has to pull the plow. The plots of land are 5 acres. No, it's hard to get it to market. And this industrial corn coming into the country would, in fact, force them off the land because they couldn't compete. That worst-case scenario was 10 million farmers. The Carnegie Endowment came out with an evaluation in the 10th year of NAFTA, that was just a couple of years ago, in which they documented the forced removal of 1.4 million Mexican farmers from the land. Each farmer has a family, and the average farm family is 5, so if we do the multiples there, we're more than halfway to the worst-case scenario. And so we're talking, you know, 6-7 million farmers being forced off the land and into the immigration stream.
I was just going to say, because as remember John Ross, as I opened our conversation, I said so many Americans only think of Mexico and Mexicans in terms of illegal immigration, but here we have a direct connection, don't we?
Yeah, I hesitate to use the word illegal. You know, we're talking about undocumented workers.
Right, I agree.
You know, no one is illegal. And indeed, this economy needs those workers. This economy can't grow without immigrant workers, and it's always been that way with this economy. So, you know, this argument about illegal immigrants is kind of, you know, a specious argument. Anyway, you know, this it's not good news on both sides of the border. In Mexico, of course, you know, this great drain on the country that's put in 2.4 million in the last 6 years during the presidency of the outgoing president, the ex-president now, Vicente Fox. On the other side of the border is a great drain on Mexico and the communities from which the workers come come from. They are, of course, putting money into those communities with their remission to the tune of $16 billion a year. It is Mexico's, now its major source of income, although the price of oil has been greatly inflated. So we're talking in the, we're talking in maybe first or second in terms of dollar source for Mexico. It is Mexico's poverty program. Without those remissions, in fact, whole regions of the country would go belly up and are in the process of going belly up. And, you know, that immigration flow provides a what they always what's always been termed by the so-called experts as a safety valve. We're talking mostly about young workers, men and women now. And without that safety valve, the potential for revolution in Mexico and great social upheaval is always on the agenda. It's always on the agenda anyway, but, you know, that safety valve is shut down by a triple barrier wall that's, you know, in the makings now with the help of Israeli contractors that I just read the other day. We're going to, you know, we will see great social upheaval on the other side of the wall, and all of this really can be traced right back to what NAFTA has done to the agrarian economy in Mexico. Zapatista saw that coming way back in 94 and rose up in rebellion, declared war on their own government, and that war, of course, is abated, but there is no peace settlement. The fact that there is no shooting war doesn't mean that there's peace. It's been a very uneasy tension that's existed not just in Chiapas, but much more recently in this last month in Oaxaca, just next door to Chiapas, another state with a very large indigenous population.
Yeah, this is all, by the way, as you're telling the story, John Ross, I should tell our listeners that this is in the southernmost Mexico, Chiapas being the southernmost province where the Zapatistas are headquartered. And also, the Zapatistas, besides being an indigenous Mayan movement, concerned about what NAFTA is doing to them, it seems more than that, particularly contained in the subtitle of your book, Making Another World Possible. It seems like they have enunciated a view beyond just things as they were, for instance.
Well, I think that's true. We've seen a progress. I documented the it was actually my fourth book on the Zapatistas, and in a previous volume, The War Against Oblivion, which is precisely what the Zapatistas call their struggle, the war against forgetting, La Guerra Contra el Olvido. You know, I document changes in how the Zapatistas have viewed the outside world. Again, they are, you know, very insular, in a very insular geographic position, just 20 kilometers from the Guatemalan border. In some of their communities, we're talking about more than 1,100 communities organized into 29 autonomous municipalities or counties, and themselves organized into five regional centers in southeastern Chiapas, probably taking into account 100,000 or more indigenous people. Not a huge movement, but nonetheless an extremely vital and important movement. Its relationship with the government has been a strained one. And after after the government and the legislative branch of the government had mutilated an Indian rights law that they had struggled for many years, in 2001 the Zapatistas declared themselves autonomous of the federal government, and indeed have begun to and are in process of building their this other world. The slogan that the anti-globalization movement has always advanced, another world is possible, is actually being made, being brought into reality in southeastern Chiapas these days. That's what precisely the last 6 years or so the Zapatista struggle have been focused on making this other world possible.
Well, now, every political state covets its centralized power and its exclusive power. Now, here you have this what used to be called, maybe still is, I mean, this situation of dual power. It was crushed mercilessly in Oaxaca just recently. How have the Zapatistas been able to, in a sense, secede from Mexico without suffering what the people of Oaxaca had?
Well, I don't think it's a secession. In fact, the Zapatistas would be the first to tell you that they are Mexicans. They just want to be Mexicans on their own terms, those own terms being autonomy. And indeed, the Zapatista movement was crushed ruthlessly by the Cedillo government between 94 and 2000. And much of what has happened in Oaxaca happened in Chiapas during those years. The Zapatistas are essentially getting off the grid is probably the best way to describe it, putting together their own educational system with their own curriculum and their own healthcare system, utilizing native ways of healing, forming all sorts of collectives, financing this infrastructure of their autonomy, basically through the sale of organic coffee. And, you know, one of the most, I think, illuminating examples of getting off the grid is in a place called La Realidad, the reality, which is really close to the Guatemalan border, where the Zapatistas have an important public center, where, in fact, they've gotten off the electricity grid, and thanks to the Solidarity Movement, are now generating their own electricity. And there are some nights in the jungle when it's the only spot where the lights are on. So, you know, a really graphic illustration of how they've gotten off the grid. The situation in Chiapas, you know, was parallel with the stealing of the July election. Much of this is recorded in the new book. And the government in the process of changing hands, and the victory of Felipe Calderon severely questioned, applied maximum force to Oaxaca at this moment. I think to tip their hand as to what's in store. Repression is definitely on the menu in Mexico these days, and the stealing of the election was only the first step. The taking of hundreds of prisoners in Oaxaca, sending them to states way up in the north and jailing them in states, the death of 19 people at the hands of a death squad, there's no other way to describe it, by the very entrenched governor, Ulises Ruiz, including the death of a U.S. journalist, Brad Will, indie media reporter, independent reporter who worked with us a lot during the years, you know, is an indication that repression is definitely on the menu. And I have certain fears for the safety of the Zapatistas as well as for the popular movement in Oaxaca.
Well, let me reintroduce the book. I'm getting fascinated by the story, not doing my proper job as a talk show host. You're listening to the Peter Werbe Show, and my guest is John Ross. He's written the fourth in a series of books on the Mexican resistance movement in Chiapas state. It's called Zapatistas, Making Another World Possible, Chronicles of Resistance, 2000-2006, and it's published by Nation Books. You can go to nationbooks.org and pick up on that. Also, at peterwerbe.com, there'll be a link as well. John Ross, why do you think that there's so little reported on this in the U.S. press? I mean, I find it from time to time in the New York Times, but certainly not in the Detroit papers, and not on very, very little on the certainly on the evening news. This is our neighbors. If this was happening in Canada, everything that's going on that you described, it would probably be blaring headlines and first story news, but we don't hear much of it.
I agree. You know, the world operates on an east-to-west bias much more than it operates on a south-to-north bias. And so what, you know, what we hear about the South, basically those hot-button issues, you know, the report is print journalism, which, you know, is not really the main way the news gets out these days. Four papers like in Detroit, like in the Midwest, is pretty much AP reportage. They don't have correspondents in Mexico or in Latin America. They may send a reporter down every once in a while, but you're picking up basically on the AP dispatch. And so, you know, it's kind of the gateway, New York Times, and Washington Post and LA Times and the Wall Street Journal all carry reporters in Mexico. So you will see more reportage on those pages, but, you know, often that reportage is is skewed. As a guy that's always been an independent reporter, you know, 50 years of doing this work, I understand that the corporate press really reports on the corporate world and takes the corporate viewpoint. And so, indeed, they kind of look down on the social movements, whereas, you know, from on high, whereas my kind of reporting and the work I do is basically on the barricades from the bottom on up. It's a different worldview and a different way of expressing it, and so mm-hmm. it has little space in the corporate media.
Well, you mentioned and you talk about in your book, Zapatistas, about the July 2006 Mexican election. Now, it's been reported since 2000, Al Gore believed the election was stolen from him in 2000, and that John Kerry thinks that the election was stolen from him in Ohio in 2004, and both of them said or did nothing. A little different response from the Mexican people who feel that their candidate was cheated out of the election.
Yeah, I think that's true. In you know, the benchmark for us was not 2000 and 2004, but 1988, when the election was stolen from another left candidate, Cuauhtemoc Cárdenas, by Carlos Salinas, the guy that did negotiate the North American Free Trade Agreement. Very much. That was the first computerized election, the first cybernetic tabulation of the results, and the computers went down on election night and didn't come up for 10 days, and when they did, Salinas was declared the winner by a little over 50%, I think 50.2% of the votes. This time around, the computers are much better. You don't have to crash the computers to rig the results, and this was an election in which the evidence of the rigging of the election is, you know, unquestionable. Everything's on videotape now. You know, when we look at the tabulations of less than 10% opening of all the ballot boxes and less than 10% of the polling places, we find out that the left candidate, López Obrador, actually won the election. There's a real track as to how that was reported in the U.S. press. Even before the preliminary count was finished, the electoral authorities in Mexico announced that Calderon had won. It was picked up by the L.A. Times, the Chicago Tribune, Boston Globe, Washington Post. They crowned Calderon in the first 24 hours after the election. And so, you know, the perception in the U.S. is indeed that the right-wing candidate won the election. There was gross underreporting of these incredible demonstrations that took place immediately after the election. There was one, it's certainly the largest political demonstration in the history of Mexico, 2 million people in the streets protesting the stealing of the election. It was underreported by over a million marchers in the New York Times, by Ginger Thompson, and even by more on the AP dispatches filed by Mark Stevenson, who, you know, I would see at the rallies, leaving before the rallies had actually been consummated, so he never really did get a count. That became the base count for U.S. reportage. So there's a real distortion, diminishment of this movement in the U.S., and one, you know, looks back at 2000 and 2004 and didn't see much reaction, kind of amazed Mexicans that there wasn't much of a reaction in the U.S., and by diminishing the actual resistance in Mexico in the U.S. reportage here, it is really a continuation of that way of saying, well, just accept the results and go on about your business. Well, I don't know that people are going to do that in Mexico over the next 6 years.
Well, what sort of stability is there in Mexico? You have this ongoing protest against the Calderon presidency, thought to be illegitimate by tens of millions of people. You still have this movement of resistance in Oaxaca. As you chronicle in your book, Zapatistas, you have this almost autonomous region in the south of Mexico. I mean, one can't imagine that, for instance, in the United States and what that would portend for here. What does it portend for Mexico? It doesn't seem like stability is what we have there.
Well, you know, this election was actually, I think, the most important election that the country has faced in many a year, if not in many a century. It really was about rich versus poor and brown versus white. It was about class and race issues. Mexico is a country where 73 million out of 103 million people live in and around the poverty line. That doesn't give you much room for a middle class. And, you know, these are people that have traditionally been agrarian people that have migrated onto the cities where there isn't enough work for anybody at all. And the country is always leaking bad gas from down below. In a real sense, the whole narco-terror problem in Mexico stems from the fact that people don't have any other way of making a living. And, you know, farmers rent out their fields and, you know, people down at the bottom, you know, pick up a little bit of chump change, you know, through the narco trades, but that's seriously destabilizing the country. You know, we have the military now in the state of Michoacan, from where many people in the United States come from, because there's been a narco war that's gone on for months. So it's another factor in the destabilization. You can't, you know, it just doesn't work. Neoliberalism, which privatizes the protections that the people demand, you know, their health care and their transportation systems and their phone companies and all those services that governments are supposed to provide, and leaves them without protection and forces them to migrate from the lands on which they've traditionally lived. And, you know, again, three-quarters of the population living in and around the poverty line is not a good indicator of social stability. And a triple barrier war wall to shut off the safety valve from that country is almost a prescription for social eruption down on the other side of the border, down south.
Well, John Ross, tell me if you think I'm incorrect in this, but I suspect if you interviewed Americans, probably 80% of them would say that North America includes the United States and Canada, even though that North American Free Trade Agreement includes Mexico, because Mexico is in North America. And if you think about distribution of income, you have you know, two countries at the top, although there's maldistribution of wealth in this country, and some in Canada as well. It's all pretty distorted, but that the North America is a fairly wealthy region, except Mexico is getting way the short end of the stick, right?
Well, you can't really wed two economies, you know, like the U.S. and Mexico. The U.S. economy is 25 times the size of the Mexican economy. We can talk about, you know, the increased trade between Mexico and the U.S., but it's not really between Mexico and the U.S. at all. It's between, you know, various branches of transnational corporations. It's Ford Mexico exporting to Ford Detroit. It's, you know, it's Chrysler Mexico doing the same. So, you know, it's not really one country exporting, you know, increasing its trade with another. It's the corporations taking advantage of the low wage scales in order to move their operations down south and then exporting basically to themselves, trading amongst themselves. This is, again, not a good formula for trickle down. You know, the famous old Ronald Reagan trickle down. It just does not trickle down.
John Ross, we're almost out of time, and we haven't spent much time on the title of your book, My Fault Indeed. But the Zapatistas, the movement in Chiapas, what's ahead? Do they have a future? Can they expand their base? Can they increase their autonomy? Are they safe from the central government repression?
Well, the latter, I can't give you an answer on that. I would hope that the moral indignation of a movement which has grown to be an international movement would stay the hand of the government in terms of trying to repress the communities. For the last year, the Zapatistas have been moving around the country, organizing what they call the other campaign, but putting together a network, weaving a network of social resistance in small communities down at the bottom, out in the countryside, and in the big cities, talking to the poorest of Mexicans, listening to them out, people that never held a microphone in their hands before, hearing what the local problems are, encouraging resistance down at the bottom against the Walmart, against the tourist development, against the taking of their lands, whatever it is, and trying to put that together in a national movement. That's the future of not only the Zapatistas, but the future of Mexico as well.
Well, thank you, John Ross. And I just wanted to add just a little note of my own. The admirable struggle of the Zapatistas, the people against the election, the Mexican election being stolen, the people of Oaxaca taking part in the resistance that they have, it's also a model for us. I don't mean violence, and I mean the violence has always come from the government, but much of what they do is possible here as well, because another world is possible, and that's the subtitle of John Ross's book, Zapatistas, Making Another World Possible, Chronicles of Resistance 2000 to 2006. It's a Nation book. You can go to nationbooks.org. There'll be a link to John's book and Nation Books on my site, peterwerby.com. John, thanks for joining me on the show.
Thanks for having me, Peter.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. A pleasure to be with you. And I'd like to look at a few issues that that are present in law enforcement. Our whole idea about crime, punishment, who are the criminals in this society, who should be criminalized, what sort of behavior. Joining me is the former police chief of Seattle, Norm Stamper. Norm Stamper was a policeman for 34 years, the last six of which was spent as the chief of Seattle's police department. He has a brand new book out, published by Nation Books. It's called Breaking Rank, a Top Cop's Exposé of the Dark Side of American Policing. And joining me from Washington State, Norm Stamper. Norm, welcome to the Peter Werby Show. Pleasure to have you with me.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah. Now, maybe just explain as a way of the theme of your book what this all means, Breaking Rank and the Dark Side of American Policing.
Well, with the exception of my first year, my rookie year as a police officer, which I do describe in some detail in the book, I have considered myself an agent of change in American law enforcement, starting really with myself, and then moving on to the larger institution of American policing.
And I'm convinced, Peter, that there is a need for radical reform of American law enforcement. So the book is it's part polemic and part memoir, to use my publisher's description.
Okay, and what's the dark side that you say you're going to expose?
The dark side, for an awful lot of people, is unfortunately well illuminated, but within policing it's often dark, and for those who are sort of blind supporters of law enforcement, it's shadowy as well. That would describe, I think, the extent to which racism, sexism, homophobia, and other brands of bigotry are alive and well in American law enforcement.
And how does it play itself out? I was going to say also that, I think there ought to be a better word, but classism, obviously in the big cities, particularly in the ones, a lot of them in the east here, but on the west coast as well, you have a large bulk of poor people where a good percentage of the crimes come from. So that you have essentially either upper working class or sometimes even middle class police officers dealing with very, very oftentimes very, very poor people that they're policing,
and often unsympathetically, needless to say, as well as unwisely. I think classism is a reality in the larger society to a very large extent, and that's certainly also true of really all of its public institutions, including what I consider to be the most sensitive of those public institutions, policing.
Mm-hmm. Norm Stamper, you didn't mention brutality. This comes up from time to time, and maybe in terms of your book, Breaking Rank, we can even talk about the situation in Seattle a few years back. But normally Seattle is thought of as a much nicer, kinder place, say, than certainly the scandals in L.A., New Orleans, including what just happened. Do you think that brutality is endemic? Is it a systemic problem across the United States?
You know, I do believe that's so. In the two departments that I know most intimately, namely the San Diego and Seattle Police Departments, starting a number of years ago, a real emphasis was placed on individual accountability and making sure that police officers understood that they were entitled to use only that amount of force necessary to effect an arrest or to perform their lawful duties. And I'm pleased to say that those are at least two agencies where that accountability for that kind of behavior was manifested in education and training, the selection process as well, but also in discipline. I made it clear to my cops in Seattle that no matter how provoked you may feel, to use excessive force is absolutely unacceptable, and it will get you fired.
Well, you tell me. Now, these aren't statistics. This is coming off the top of my head. But as I remember, charges of brutality usually are leveled against a small percentage of any particular police force, rather. But what is also interesting, well, let me tell you sort of anecdotally. Friends I have, people I know, relatives that I know that are in the Detroit police, as far as I know and as far as I've told them, none of them have ever had a charge of brutality or misconduct or anything. Against them. On the other hand, they don't have many arrests, and you find out that there's a coincidence, and correct me if I'm wrong, that these men that often get accused of brutality also have high number of commendations and arrests.
You know, that is certainly true of many agencies. In fact, I would dare say most big city police departments in the country, that there is a pattern of practices that really cries out for examination and for the exercise of very strong, decisive leadership to either get the attention of these individuals or get them the hell out of the organization, because they're poison. And it's really tragic when police leaders don't take care of that end of the business, and when police unions so quickly and sometimes all too often effectively come to the defense of the behavior of officers who are engaged in patterns of brutality. And then there's the elected officials. Mm-hmm. I think there are many elected officials who are just wary of, if not frightened, of police unions, and they don't exercise the kind of leadership that we elect them to exercise.
Norm Stamper is my guest on the Peter Werbe Show. He's the former chief of the Seattle Police. He has a brand new book out called Breaking Rank, A Top Cop's Exposé of the Dark Side of American Policing. Just one more thing I've always been curious about, and I want to get more to your story, and that is that we always hear about the blue what's it called, the
It's been called a number of things. If I can anticipate what you're asking, the blue wall of silence.
The blue wall of silence. All right.
Sure.
On the other hand, so you think, why would these basically decent people not give the goods up on somebody that's being brutal? And one aspect of it, I mean, there is certainly solidarity within paramilitary organization, and you have to depend on other people. But someone told me once, an officer, that these are the guys that are going to wade into like a big fight or tackle somebody that's not going to submit to arrest easily. Or when there's an armed man in a building, they're the ones that are going to go in. So in a sense, the brutal cops are sort of the muscle of big city policing.
Well, they certainly are, and one of the things that I think is poorly understood and often misunderstood by the public is that policing is a culture unto itself, and there are elements of that culture that make the kind of behavior you're describing understandable, if not predictable, and what that begins to suggest for me is the need to sort of rearrange the way the molecules are organized and go about radical restructuring of America's police forces, which will produce the kind of cultural change that we need.
I want to talk about that. Let's talk a little just about you. You talked about individual change. I mean, yourself, Norm Stamper, the author of Breaking Rank. What kind of changes did you go through? This sort of reform-minded idea, I mean, I don't hear too much of that. So you must have gone through quite a change yourself. Could you? I mean, we have some time here. You just, from a rookie to chief of police. What occurred? I mean, I know people should read the book. They get a better idea. But sort of a summary.
Well, a summary for me goes something like this. When I became a cop, it was after 21 years of childhood and adolescence in which I had what I consider to be now vaguely idealistic notions about the way the world ought to operate. I had had some personal experience with the police that wasn't pleasant, but it wasn't outrageous either. But I had also seen on television in the 60s, before I became a cop, Birmingham Bull O'Connor sicking his minions on peacefully demonstrating civil rights protesters, and I was aghast. I mean, I felt physically ill watching those police dogs chomping down on the legs of men and women and children, and fire hoses trained on the demonstrators and the like. So when I became a cop, which was for me more or less accidental, putting it briefly, I needed a new job. I was recently married, and my wife and I were living in the National City Veterinary Hospital, where I was a veterinary assistant. And I got married at 20; she was 18. I had already been there for about 3 years, and it was not a pleasant arrangement living in an apartment on the grounds. So at any rate, I'm looking for a new job, and I accompany a friend to take the police test, thinking, well, it's outdoor work. It eventually will pay more than what I was getting there. And long story short, I passed the test and I become a cop. Within the briefest period of time, I mean, it's almost breathtaking to me looking back on it how radically I changed within weeks or months. I began saying things I'd never said before in my life. I began doing things I'd never done before in my life. And by the time I completed my rookie year, I was a thug in uniform. I enjoyed the power that I had. I enjoyed even more abusing that power. And it manifested pretty much across the board in terms of excessive force. I would bait people into taking a swing at me so that I could choke them out using what was called then as the standard police sleeper hold. If I didn't tell awful racist jokes, I laughed at them uproariously. I was definitely involved in what I would consider to be not gay bashing, but gay trashing. And I just, I was just having a grand old time of it, being, you know, an obnoxious, caustic, cynical, and fun-loving abuser of my fellow citizens.
Now, were you the small percentage, or was this behavior that seemed across the board in San Diego police?
Well, my colleagues of that era would refute this or attempt to refute it, but they would be wrong. It was common, what I'm describing now, the racism, the sexism, the homophobia, the brutality, the cynicism, the distance, really, between cops and the citizens that police officers are hired to serve. So I would describe it as patterned and definitely institutionalized. And there's been progress. My comeuppance, incidentally, Peter, came at the hands of a principled prosecutor who braced me in the hall of the San Diego County Courthouse. I had brought to him at about 14 months on the job, I brought to him an arrest of a 19-year-old. I call him a kid in the book. I was only 3 years his senior, but I arrested this 19-year-old. He happened to be white. He could just as easily have been black, for being drunk in a public place and unable to care for himself or the safety of others, which satisfied the requirements of 647F of the California Penal Code, namely drunk in a public place. And the only problem was he wasn't drunk, but he had an attitude. And nonetheless, I knew exactly how to handle this when I got the subpoena. I had seen it done. So I stride into the courthouse, and I sidle up to the prosecutor and give him a wink and a nudge, and I tell him, you probably want to dismiss this case. And he said, why? I said, well, it's kind of skinny. And he said, what do you mean by that? I said, well, it's more or less a kind of an attitude arrest. And his response to that was to look me in the eye and ask me if the Constitution of the United States meant anything to me.
Hmm.
And I was outraged for about 7 seconds. And then I was deeply embarrassed. And by the time he did dismiss the case, but by the time I slithered down the steps of the courthouse out into the bright sunshine, I was literally saturated in shame. I could hardly walk. I just felt like I'd been busted. Everything that I thought I believed in, I had seemingly abandoned when I became a cop. I was enjoying the life, and here this guy has the nerve to slap me upside the head and let me know that my behavior was not only unappreciated by him, it was unlawful, and it got my attention. And that, there were a couple of other factors that were brewing at the time, but that was the triggering event. And from that point on, I've made it my business to at least try to behave myself and to see what we could do to make the institution more responsive and responsible as well.
Well, Norm Samber, I didn't even think of the conversation going in this direction, but if we skip way up to 1999, people are saying Seattle Police Chief Norm Stamper is the Bull Connor of the anti-WTO demonstrations. How do I
plead?
Yeah, I don't know. I wasn't going to say that. What's your impression? Or how do you plead? Whatever, however you want to...
The chapter in my book, it's 28, on the WTO, is called Snookered in Seattle. And the long and the short of it is, I thought as police chief in that city that we were ready for the WTO ministerial conference, for the demonstrators, for the media, for this very, very large event in a very small city, 530,000 people. And we had spent 10,000 hours in planning and preparation, all of it oriented toward ensuring that protesters of globalization would have an opportunity to state their minds and to engage the community. If they couldn't get a hold of the ministers of the WTO, at least the media and the community in a dialogue about the evils of globalization. So, and Seattle had developed, I think you alluded to this earlier, had developed a reputation of being very accommodating of demonstrations. typically coming from the left, but also from the right, and attempting to work with demonstration leaders to provide a forum for the expression of their particular concerns. In this case, we were simply too small a city and too small a county and too small a state to be able to handle the 50,000 demonstrators and the small portion of that larger crowd that was engaged in clearly violent acts. And I will confide to you and to your listeners that it took me 5 years of retirement to come to the conclusion that I was really wrong about one major aspect of the WTO, the police response to WTO.
Mm-hmm.
I had said in my book, and this is why I pray for a second edition, so that I can come clean on that issue, that we had no choice but to gas nonviolent demonstrators who had linked arms and sat down in an intersection, 6th and Union, for anybody that knows that city, next to the Sheraton Hotel and a block away from the convention center where the conference was underway. My rationale for supporting a decision by my field commanders to declare an unlawful assembly and issue warning after warning after warning and then finally use gas, the euphemism being chemical agents, was that we had 5 or 6 other demonstrations and large contingents of protesters converging on the area at the same time, and we were completely overwhelmed. But it was a huge mistake. Now, the cop in me at the time, and the cop in me that is a very important piece of who I am, for 5 years has held on to this belief that we had to clear that intersection because it was a critical strategic location surrounded by high-rise office buildings, by thousands upon thousands of demonstrators, and the convention center conference delegates. So my rationale in supporting the decision, I didn't actually make the decision, but in supporting it was if we had somebody on the 27th floor of the Sheraton Hotel having a heart attack or somebody on the 15th floor of another one of those office buildings in labor, that we'd have to be able to get aid cars through there, and we couldn't. There was no way that could be done, and I kept saying to myself, well, if the demonstrators will just give us a corridor through which we could move from point A to point B, that would be acceptable. But they weren't in the mood to do that, and it wasn't in the cards. And long and the short of it is we gassed them, and I supported that decision up until very recently. On the book tour, I've met demonstrators, protesters who were in Seattle, who gave me no new information, but just listening to them caused a shift in my thinking. And I now believe that the risk that medical emergency that I just described hypothetically would become real was low, and that the cost of doing what we did was altogether too high.
Well, I thank you for that, Norm Stamper. And you'll have to remind me whether your retirement was voluntary or was it, did you wind up to be sort of the bad guy in it all?
I took and I continue to take full responsibility. If you're looking for the one bad guy, that would be Norm Stamper.
Well, I don't know. I'll leave that to you and to your book, Breaking Rank, A Top Cop's Exposé of the Dark Side of American Policing. It's published by Nation Books. Now, our time, we could probably, now that I get into this conversation, we probably could do 2 hours with this, but we only have about 3 or 4 minutes left. And what brought you to my attention were the good people at the Drug Policy Alliance. You can go to drugpolicy.org. And your op-ed piece in the Los Angeles Times on October 16th, which says, a former police chief wants to end a losing war by legalizing pot, coke, meth, and other drugs. And you say not decriminalization, but the legalization of all drugs, including heroin, cocaine, meth, psychotropics, mushrooms, and LSD. That probably sets the hair up on some people's back. Not mine, but tell us. The war on drugs, is it lost?
I think it was lost the moment it was declared during the Nixon administration era. Drug use, to my way of thinking, ought to be a civil right of all adult Americans. Drug abuse needs to be seen for what it is, namely a tragedy and a medical problem for the individual and a public health problem for society. And I might mention, Peter, I think your listeners would be also interested. I'm a huge fan of DPA, Drug Policy Alliance. Wonderful people. And another fine organization is LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. And their website is www.leap.cc. And all across the globe, we're finding police officers and judges and attorneys and DAs joining the ranks of LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. Nixon got it wrong. Previous administrations had as well, but the war on drugs was really declared during his administration, and we've now seen a succession of seven presidents waging this unwinnable war because the whole issue has been framed incorrectly and so much suffering has resulted from it.
Now, people have used the phrase prison industrial complex, which has cost the American people somewhere around $1 trillion. I know the Drug Policy Alliance has a whole campaign that they're trying to at least get the Congress to get rid of some of the worst programs that we're financing with our public dollars. And I mean, we keep talking about, where are we going to get the money for this? Where are we going to get the money from that? I mean, that's an excellent question. And I'm sure, as a former police officer, that you realize that so much of the locus of police corruption has been around the drug trafficking, hasn't it?
Almost all of it. Almost all of it across the country, and there is no city, certainly of any size, that has been spared the agony of and the specter of police officers hired to uphold the law breaking the law. And there, virtually every major city, major corruption scandal of the last two or three decades has been traceable to drugs.
Now, Norm Stamper, I don't know if you can do this in 60 seconds, but you talked about the necessity of change within the police culture and hence the police administrations. What any kind of shorthands you could give us in the time remaining?
Demilitarize it, de-bureaucratize it, create a new organizational arrangement that puts cops in closer and friendlier contact with the communities they serve. Would be a start. Treat cops with dignity and respect. And I'm speaking now to their bosses, who employ sometimes draconian disciplinary actions against minor infractions and neglecting the major infractions out there in the community.
We actually have just a few seconds left. Demilitarize. I mean, what are you saying? An English style take away their guns kind of?
No. Unfortunately, I would love to be able to take away everyone's guns in this society. That will get you some mail. But I do believe that it's necessary for the police to be armed since so many of our citizens are armed. I also believe that it's important to maintain control over police practices and to exercise discipline appropriately to ensure that in a demilitarized operation that would flatten the bureaucracy and strengthen decentralized policing, that cops at all levels still need to be held accountable.
Well, we're out of time. Norm Stamper, thanks for joining us. The book is Breaking Rank, a top cop's expose of the dark side of American policing. It's available from Nation Books. I'll have a link on my website. Thank you, Norm Stamper.
Thank you very much.
Weekday night at 10 with Meltdown. It's like getting hit in the head by a 2x4 with a nail in it. Mandatory Metallica. Now, it's your triple play of the mighty Metallica with the big unit. Every weekday night at 10, exclusively from your one and only Metallica station. 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks. This is WRIF.com.
pictures,
the podcast,
the vlogs,
the special features you just can't get
anywhere else.
Super f***ing cool.
Get them online at WRIF.com.
I salute yourself.
Or check us out at MySpace.com/WRIF.
Guaranteed to be extreme.
Because we can always use more friends, and we won't be naked.
Does anyone else smell Astroglide?
101.
WRIF.
People are sexy and clever, and they always say something funny right before a commercial break.
Every